with Attorney Michael Oppenheimer as we await to go back inside the courtroom for the sentencing hearing for former Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke, who was convicted of second-degree murder and aggravated battery last fall in the shooting death of black teen Laquan McDonald in 2014. As we prepare now to hear what both sides will present in terms of the sentencing hearing, they'll call up witnesses, that kind of thing, try to, on the defense side, plead for sympathy on some level in terms of a sentence. The judge has already been granted letters or given letters that different people have written, including Van Dyke's two young daughters who talk about having nightmares and crying themselves to sleep, that kind of thing. And just quoting the Tribune here, the eldest daughter wrote that she has last kissed or hugged her dad on the day of his conviction in October, and then, quote, "Now I touch his hand through a piece of dirty glass and speak through a phone where the connection breaks in and out." Is that the kind of thing, as heartbreaking as it is for kids, when a parent is found guilty of something, is that the kind of thing that the judge can even consider?
He can certainly consider this, because he's allowed to consider all relevant factors, whether he has a family, whether he's normally a good citizen, all of these things. He's certainly allowed to consider how much weight it has, because look, this is a high-profile case, but almost every case where there's someone in prison, they have a family member that went from seeing them and touching them the night before to, you know, looking through a piece of dirty glass. It's horrible. It's sad. And I don't want to say the judge is immune, but that's not the first time he's... The reality is, it's not the first time he's heard that. So he takes into account for sure that Van Dyke has a family, that there are innocent victims in his family that are victims of this. Same with Laquan's family. Same with the community. And so he takes that all into account, and that factors into it, but I don't think it's... I can't get into his head, but it's not a huge...
Well, does it factor in more... Or could it factor in more in Van Dyke's case, because he wasn't somebody who had prior convictions or other things of that nature, versus you think of like an El Chapo trial in New York, if they tried to get somebody up there and say, but he's a loving father.
Right. And they'll do that.
But
they'll do that,
the judge will know that, you know, yeah, but the guy's all executed people too.
Correct. You know, the other side of that argument with Van Dyke is, yeah, but it's because of Van Dyke's actions on that day that his daughter has to touch him through a piece of glass. It's Van Dyke's fault.
So it's his
own
fault.
And there's
fault.
The argument. It's his own, I would argue, from the prosecution side, it's his own fault. He brought this about. Yes, he's an innocent victim. It's horrible. But look at Laquan's family. Look at the society. It's Van Dyke's own fault. So he takes it into account, but I don't know. I think what he takes more into account of is that Van Dyke has no criminal record. That's a factor in this case, federally and in statewide, in terms of your criminal record.
I think what was interesting also in the trial, as we covered it, Laquan McDonald, I mean, going in, a lot of people, especially if you were on the police side of things, wanted to say, well, and it was argued at trial, hey, this kid was partially at fault. Why didn't he stop? Why didn't he drop the knife? A police officer tells you to do something, you do it. And then they bring out that he was high on PCP and all the rest of it. But then the counter to that is, well, that's not jurisdiction to execute somebody, shoot them 16 times.
Right.
But what also came out beyond that was a humanizing of Laquan McDonald. And we've just really heard about the tough lifetime he had. And if you read any of the background, how a lot of people really, counselors and teachers and whatnot, saw his sense of humor and saw a future for him. But he had a difficult family life, a mother who was very young when she had him, and it put him in foster care. It was just really kind of messed up, and was sort of a... I guess a picture, a window into parts of the inner city, and it was just difficult to see, and it was like, yeah, we need change. This can't continue.
Absolutely, and that's the real core problem here. He's a product of a lot of, you know, a lot of people don't have this in the inner city. A lot of people emerge and do just fine, but he's a victim of all that. And what's happened in this case, which is more unusual than other cases, is everybody, yesterday's trial, the lawyers in yesterday's trial portrayed Laquan McDonald as the instigator. They made him the bad guy. They again put Laquan McDonald on trial, and it worked for them.
And here we are. They're showing us the pictures in court now, so I guess we can listen in.
Fantastic here.
Judge speaking.
The press has been great. The media has been great. So the people that are here concerned, Laquan McDonald's family members and loved ones, Mr. Van Dyke's family, loved ones, and supporters, everybody has been fantastic. So just as, again, a matter of quality control, the reason why we're taking all the photos, if there is a disruption, your photograph is here, well, your video is here, and if there is a disruption, you will go to jail. All right, if you cause it. All right, at this time, are both sides ready?
Yes,
sir. All right, Mr. McMahon.
Given your experience and the precedent and the direction that we have from both the appellate and the Supreme Court. I talk about the indictment because the indictment sets forth not just the allegations, but the intent as reflected in the murder counts and the 16 separate counts of aggravated battery with the firearm and official misconduct. And how we then presented the evidence through those counts beyond reasonable doubt. We presented that evidence through detailed trial testimony. I want to talk about three particular areas. First was the video evidence that showed 16 separate and distinct acts committed by the defendant. It was very clear. There were video evidence that was highlighted. It was broken down. It was slowed down. That showed and convinced the jury beyond a reasonable doubt that there were 16 separate acts committed by the defendant. But then when you couple that with Dr. Arunkumar's testimony and how detailed and thorough that was, how there were 16 separate gunshot wounds, each one causing harm to the body of Laquan McDonald. And then importantly, through the cross-examination of the defendant, there were 16 separate and distinct acts where the defendant testified and revealed on cross-examination that he fired his gun 16 times as he assessed and shot, and he continued to assess and shoot that gun throughout the entire process. And he continued to shoot, striking the body. He changed his focus to the knife, according to his testimony, and he continued to do that until his gun
was empty.
The second factor that I pointed out, Judge, is, of course, the verdict. The verdict is second-degree murder, plus 16 separate verdict forms signed by every member of the jury and the foreman, foreperson, as it related to the counts, the individual counts of aggravated battery with a firearm. And then third, of course, and you know this, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, the code of corrections, the statutory factors in aggravation. But you also look at the code on sentencing and correction to determine the possibility of potential sentences. What is the more serious offense? Is it the Class X aggravated battery with a firearm, or is it the second-degree murder? And at first blush, to somebody who does not necessarily work in the system, when you hear the term second-degree murder, it sounds like a more serious offense. But under the laws of this state, under the sentencing code, under the decisions of both the appellate and the Supreme Court in our state, aggravated battery with a firearm is a more serious offense, and the Illinois Supreme Court has given us direction on how sentences should and must be imposed when there is a verdict on both aggravated battery with a firearm and second-degree murder. We lay out this argument in the brief that we filed earlier this week. There's just a couple of cases that I want to highlight in that brief, Judge. The first is the Bishop case. That's on page 3. It starts at paragraph 8 of our brief. And in People versus Bishop, the Illinois Supreme Court reiterated that multiple convictions are proper where the state consistently treats the defendant's
acts as separate in the indictment and at the trial. And so when this case was presented to the grand jury and the grand jury returned an indictment, the indictment that we proceeded to trial on, there were 16 separate counts. And we, in detail, sometimes painstakingly, and it was uncomfortable to hear some of the detail about the damage and the injury that the gunshot wounds caused to Laquan McDonald, but that theory was put before the grand jury. That theory never changed, and it continued through opening statement, through the presentation of our case, through our closing argument. And that was responded to from the jury, that those allegations were proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Once you resolve that issue, I think the Supreme Court has told us in Bishop, and I think the Supreme Court has told us, as I just said in Bishop, how that case has to be resolved. You then have to resolve the issue of whether or not you sentence the defendant on the less serious charge of second-degree murder. And again, the Illinois Supreme Court has addressed that issue for us, and they've done that in the Lee cases. Now, the Lee case, People versus Lee, which again is cited in our memorandum, it starts on page 4, paragraph 10. But the Lee case worked its way through the appellate.
2004 case.
It is, yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
And it worked its way through both the appellate court. There was a supervisory order issued by the Supreme Court that sent the case back to the appellate court, and then it came back. But as the Supreme Court in its decision in People versus Lee said, this court must sentence the defendant, Jason Van Dyke, on the more serious charge, which they reiterated in that decision. They set out in the Bishop decision that the more serious charge in this case is the Class X aggravated battery with a firearm. Now, let me talk about sentencing on the legal issues just on sentencing on aggravated battery with a firearm, Judge. And as you know well enough, for each count of aggravated battery with a firearm, where you find that the battery caused severe bodily injury, the sentence for each count shall run consecutively. Now, let me be clear on this point. The sentences for aggravated battery with a firearm, if you find severe bodily injury for each count, those sentences must run consecutively. If you impose, and I'm going to ask you to impose a sentence on second-degree murder as well, and I'll finish up with that, but any sentence that you impose on second-degree murder may run concurrently with any sentence that you impose on aggravated battery with firearm. So let me get back to the aggravated battery with firearm. The testimony of Dr. Arun Kumar was crystal clear and more than persuasive, really eliminated beyond all doubt about the injuries that those gunshots caused. But the Supreme Court has told us, they have told you in every court in this state, that the trial judge is in the best decision, in the best position to make that determination. And not every gunshot that strikes a human being equates to severe bodily injury. We set out kind of a survey of some of the cases that we were able to find that found severe bodily injury and gunshot wounds that struck a human being that did not cause severe bodily injury. My point, Judge, is that you're in the best position to make that, given not only your position here in this case, but your experience hearing cases and your decision, according to the Illinois Supreme Court, is entitled to and will be given and should be given great deference, to quote the Illinois Supreme Court. I'm not going to belabor the testimony of Dr. Arun Kumar or what the injuries were. Again, I think that testimony was crystal clear during the trial, but there is ample evidence for you to make a finding of severe bodily injury on one count, on two counts, whether that's three counts or all 16, anywhere in that range. But let me talk about one of the defendant's own witnesses, Dr. Tees. Her testimony, their own expert, testified that at least two of the gunshots caused severe bodily injury, and that those were the only two gunshots that were fatal. So if you accept that testimony for purposes of sentencing, and if you resolve that one issue in favor of the defendant, then the minimum sentence is 12 years plus the non-triggering offense, or a minimum of 18 years in the Illinois Department of Corrections. If you find that all 16 counts cause severe bodily injury, as we've discussed, as we have set forth in our legal memorandum, then the minimum on this case is as high as 96 years. And now we have another issue to resolve that you have to consider. You have to consider a constitutional issue as it relates to proportionate penalties. The state charged Jason Van Dyke with first-degree murder. Had the jury returned a verdict on first-degree murder, as we all know in this courtroom, the minimum sentence would have been 14 years. A sentence of 96 years, more than twice the minimum sentence would have been 45 years is what I said.
Good, thank you.
If you find all 16 counts must run consecutive, then the minimum sentence is 96 years for the aggravated battery with a firearm. That's more than two times the minimum sentence for first-degree murder, and I think that raises constitutional issues about proportionate penalties, Your Honor. And so that is a factor, whatever your decision is, and you know this, Judge, that you have to take into account and address that issue. I'm going to be asking you, after we hear aggravation and mitigation, for you to impose a sentence on both the aggravated battery with firearm and the second degree murder. And here's why. Again, the Illinois Supreme Court in the Lee decision, but also the Crespo, C-R-E-S-P-O, that was a 2003 decision, Judge. I think I'm misquoting that, but we cited that citation.
Is that the stabbing case?
That is the stabbing case, yes, sir. Multiple stab wounds to a child and both armed violence and a aggravated battery and attempt murder in that case. Unlike the Crespo case and unlike the Lee case, we did separate out the individual counts. We did present evidence on all 16 counts. But when you look at all of the evidence, there is sufficient evidence for you to impose a sentence on both second-degree murder and the aggravated battery with firearm. We've raised the issues about judicial economy, about imposing, you've heard all of the evidence about imposing a sentence on both aggravated battery with firearm and a second-degree murder. The Illinois Supreme Court has said very clearly that aggravated battery is a more serious offense. You must, according to the Supreme Court, impose a sentence on those counts. But there is sufficient evidence, and there is ample legal reason for you to impose a concurrent sentence on the second-degree murder. And after we hear aggravation and mitigation, we'll ask you to impose a sentence on both.
Thank you very much, Mr. McMahon. Mr. O'Brien.
Judge, the One Act, One Crime rule, or doctrine of merger in Illinois, applies in this case. In fact, the state has argued in motions during this case that the aggravated batteries are lesser included of the murder, and in fact they are. As a result of that, and the fact that all of the wounds that comprise the aggravated battery were death-causing wounds, the aggravated battery is a lesser included of the second degree and first degree murder that had to be reached by the jury before reaching second degree murder. Now, the state has cited several cases, including the Illinois Supreme Court and other highly regarded sources, that individual wounds can be treated as individual crimes, and they can, but just not in this case. In Crespo, it was three stab wounds to the thigh, but that victim lived. So there was no, what I would say is greater crime that occurred here. So that can be, could be three attempt murders, three aggravated batteries, whatever it was. But that can't, that does not apply and cannot apply when the aggravated batteries are lesser included of the murder. In this case, another way to look at it is was impossible to commit the murder without committing the aggravated batteries. In this case, where all the aggravated battery injuries were death-causing wounds, according to the state's expert. The defendant cannot be sentenced on both offenses. The merger doctrine applies. So the question is, what merges into what? The common sense answer to that would be the lesser harm merges into the greater harm. The woundings merge into the death. There are cases that suggest maybe it goes the other way, but there are several reasons, there's at least one case, Lee I'm talking about, which Mr. McMahon mentioned, but it must merge into second degree for several different reasons. Number one, if you merge into the aggravated battery, it effectively eliminates second degree as a crime in Illinois. Let me explain that. Any defendant prosecuted for first-degree murder, the state chooses to hedge their bets and also charge a Class X aggravated battery with a firearm or an attempt murder, which is a Class X. Both those Class X's would merge into a finding of first-degree. Nobody in this courtroom, I doubt anybody in this courtroom would argue with that point. So a finding is first-degree. The ag bat or the attempt murder merges into the first degree. That same position applies to second degree murder. Essentially, though, what you would have in every case where the prosecution chose to charge the case in the manner as described and as they did here, second degree is off the table. Even though the legislature enacted second degree murder, no one would ever be convicted and have judgment entered or be sentenced upon it if you merge this into the aggravated battery. The state relies a lot on Lee, and at first glance, that seems to be an on-point type case, but it's not. It's distinguishable for a couple different reasons. First, look at the opinion itself. It's based on another opinion from the 60s, but within that Lee opinion, there's a dissent. One of the justices dissented with the majority's analysis, debating the method with which they analyze what's the higher class and what's the lower class. But the main reason it's distinguishable is because the Lee court was never asked to look at that second degree argument that I just mentioned. They were never asked to consider whether or not the elimination of second degree murder, thereby merging when the second degree merged into the aggravated battery, whether that was proper or not. That makes Lee distinguishable. But luckily, we do have guidance from both the Illinois Supreme Court and Illinois Appellate Court as to whether or not, by virtue of the way they charge the case, the state can eliminate second degree, which has happened here. And I've cited in our memo also, which I'll adopt for purposes of this argument, anything I don't talk about, I'll ask you to consider that. There are cases, Drakeford and Morgan, Illinois Supreme Court cases, that said you can't do that. You cannot charge a case in a way that eliminates second-degree murder. There are appellate court cases. The most recent one that I found, Space, was a 2018 case. There's Rosenthal, 2008. All of which say the state cannot charge a case in a way that eliminates second-degree murder. In fact, in doing so, they make second-degree murder a nullity. So how does it merge then? The reason the cases merge is based upon what I said, how it merges. As you know, and as everybody knows in this courtroom, before a defendant can be found guilty of second-degree murder, the trier of fact, in this case the jury, has to conclude that the elements of first-degree murder have been met. It's at that moment that the merger occurs, because even if they later determine there are mitigating factors, as they did here, does not change the fact that the elements of first-degree murder were reached before consideration on the mitigating factors. Once that happens, the aggravated battery merges into the murder counts. Additionally, if you merge it the other way, you eliminate or negate the jury's deliberations. They were out for a while on this case. They put a lot of thought into this. They decided what the elements were, and they decided there are mitigating factors in the evidence here that allow them to reduce first degree, second degree. If you merge this into the aggravated battery, their deliberations are out the window. As a result, Mr. Van Dyke must be sentenced to second degree, in our opinion. If, however, you think otherwise, and you merge it the other way, the state has talked about in their memo and orally right now that they believe some of these counts should be consecutive. It's true. There's a section of the statute, 584, says that if there's multiple injuries and severe bodily injury occurs during those injuries to the victim of the injuries, that's a triggering offense for mandatory consecutive. But in this case, those aren't the injuries. You have a case here where every one of those wounds that are the subject of the aggravated battery caused death. Death is the injury in this case, not the individual aggravated battery. Thinking about it, it would be extremely unfair to punish Mr. Van Dyke for shooting and wounding somebody and then having those same wounds be the cause of death, and you punish him for death too. That is exactly why the merger doctrine exists, and that is why he must be sentenced as to only one count. And in this particular case, because if you choose to merge into the aggravated battery, it's the defense position that you can sentence him to one count, 6 to 30 years, because death is the injury, and so therefore there's nothing to be consecutive to. I also agree with Mr. McMahon that there's proportionate penalties issues here. The fact that the minimum for the aggravated batteries could be as high as 96 years, and the maximum for second-degree murder is 20, leaves a difference of 76 years. We agree that would be either the proportionate penalty argument under those circumstances. In this case, however, Lee is not controlling, and we're asking that the court sentence the defendant on second degree.
Mr. McMahon, anything else?
No.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, as I had said earlier, we're going to take a recess, and then we're going to go into the other phase of the sentencing, which will be the state will present aggravation and aggravation witnesses. The defense will present a mitigation and mitigation witnesses. Do we have the interpreter here yet, Mr. McMahon? So, okay. We'll adjust. I know. Thank you very much. All right. There'll be a recess at this time.
So some very interesting legal arguments on both sides. What the prosecution argued to start with is pretty much what you had outlined, they would say. But the defense argument here in terms of how to interpret the law was something I guess we hadn't fully considered. It's interesting, though. It goes back to the layman's perspective that second-degree murder seems like a bigger deal than aggravated battery, which, even though felony-wise, they're different.
It does, and it's what you said earlier. It's a creative argument. Darren O'Brien was the lawyer that argued that.
And explain about it. You know him.
I know him. He was a former supervisor in the state attorney's office. He's a very smart guy. He was the law guy for the state attorney's office at the time he worked there.
So basically what he said was, and to me, layman's terms, I'm not an attorney like you, but what I was hearing was Van Dyke was charged with first-degree murder and these aggravated batteries. First-degree murder trumps aggravated battery. So you would merge aggravated battery into first-degree murder, and the jury first had to determine first-degree murder before they could go to second-degree.
That is true.
Because so you're stuck with first degree, and then they brought it down a notch, but he's saying you can't go back to aggravated. You have to stick with second degree.
It's true. They looked at first degree. They have to find the elements of first degree, and then they find a mitigating factor, which we talked about before, which gave them second degree. And then you have all the aggravated battery. I don't know the answer here. That's going to be up to the judge.
The interesting, the defense guy, and again, this is just sort of legal eagle stuff at this point, the kind of minutia of that, of how the judge will determine and what he'll rule. But the defense attorney tried to make the point that that based on the law, you just really can't merge these differently. Yet, with that argument, in a sense, you could get more time for second degree murder, because you get up to 20 years, right? And if
yes.
The aggravated battery was only going to be considering what the prosecution had said, we'll only consider the ones that are fatal. If you're going to go that route, the first couple of wounds, you might get 12
Correct.
Or 18 years. So you could get more, actually, the other way, but they don't think the judge would rule for the full 20 on second degree.
Right. So when we first talked about this, when I thought about this case in the beginning, I thought about arguing, well, if the first two shots killed them, then you can't consider all those other shots. They can't determine which shot killed them. Darren is saying every one of those 16 shots was fatal, and I guess the medical examiner agreed with that and said any one of them could be.
In other words, you can't kill a guy 16 times. You killed him once.
However, the problem with Darren's argument is you don't know which shot killed him, because he could have died at the 16th shot, the 14th shot. There's an argument that all those shots before he went down and then he shot him again, there's a lot of shots there that you can't determine which one killed him. So I think there could be a lot of aggravated battery shots.
But again, under the law, though, if first degree murder trumps aggravated battery in terms of felony and rating it, is
yes.
that correct?
Yes,
first degree
it does.
Trumps
it? Does.
And
yes.
if the jury had to start with first degree murder and make sure that he was guilty of that, but only then reduced it for the mitigating circumstance, I think his argument is that first degree murder trumps it, and they made that decision, and so therefore you can't go back.
I think that is his argument. I think, though, that, and I don't have the benefit of their brief in front of me in the cases that they cited, the judge is going to have to, and probably already has, looked at them in terms of, because of the second degree, I agree that there's a disproportionate sentencing. If the maximum on second degree is 20 years and he's facing 9 to 6, or we think 60 because of the statute, that's a big difference.
Sure.
So the judge has to decipher that, and that could come back on appeal if the judge were to give him the 96 or the 60 for resentencing. So I don't know what the judge is going to do.
Now, moving forward with this thing, we're going to come back from the recess, and it almost... from a layman's perspective, it's almost like presenting a sort of trial again, right? Because you're going to bring up witnesses to talk about why Van Dyke should get this lengthy sentence, or witnesses to talk about, you know, family man, all of this, why he deserves a lesser sentence. So it could be very involved and emotional at times.
I think it will be. I think Dan Herbert's going to try, maybe, and put Laquan McDonald on trial again, in showing how difficult Van Dyke's decision was to do what he had to do, and why, although the jury has ruled it was wrong, he faced a very tough decision. It wasn't this blatant, I hate you, I'm going to kill you type thing.
And the jurors did come away with that. I mean, they didn't make it first degree murder.
Right.
They didn't feel, what you kind of got from the interviews afterward, once the jury was released, was that they didn't get the sense that he was necessarily a racist or a cop that was, you know, out to kill somebody, but it just that under the circumstances, he went too far. He made a bad decision for the circumstances.
Right. I think that's what the jury said. And so I think that the witnesses will try and go to show that from the defense point of view. We'll see who the prosecution puts on. I think he'll put on some community people, maybe an expert, but probably family members or someone to speak for Laquan.
But going back to the judge, and this is the important part, because it's his decision that matters at the end of the day, because
yes.
he's the one who's going to put out a sentence. You have kind of given me the feeling that, knowing Judge Gahan the way you do, that he's really not going to be swayed by too much of the emotion of all of this. He's already seen the briefs in terms of the law and what each side is saying about how you have to sentence this. He's already decided which way he's going to go. He wasn't like thrown by what this defense guy was just saying about, oh, you got to go with first degree murder. He's already had all of that in front of him to study, correct?
Correct. I think he might take what Darren said and what Mr. McMahon said and go back and maybe highlight some things, just review it.
I think probably he's already made a decision on this particular topic. It seems like he's not going to rule on this thing first. He's going to hear all the mitigation and aggravation from the prosecution and then make a total decision.
I mean, the attorney that you know, Darren, as you said, who is on the defense side now arguing about what sentencing should be, he pointed out that the case that Prosecutor McMahon brought up to show that aggravated battery needs to be the lead. He said in that case, though, I thought I heard him say, yeah, the victim was, you know, charged with three counts or whatever it was, but he lived.
He lived.
And there's a little difference here because this person, Laquan McDonald, died. So he's trying to say death trumps the aggravated battery.
He kind of goes with that argument that you made earlier, that it seems like common sense that this guy died. Why are we worrying about aggravated battery? So from a logical point of view, it kind of makes sense, but you have to look at the jury went to second degree, and they made a point of finding him guilty on all 16 counts.
Of the aggravated battery as well, so you have to think about what the jurors did there, and the judge, I guess the judge can do whatever they want and can put aside a jury verdict if they want.
He can. He won't do that.
But as far as the system goes, the judge typically would respect what the jury did.
Correct. Putting aside the jury verdict is called the JNOV. It's a judgment notwithstanding the verdict. He hasn't overruled the jury. He's not going to do that. But both sides have now given him a little bit of an out to get way below that 96. Or in my
opinion,
for
sure the prosecution, who, if they were going to hammer 96, they wouldn't have even opened that door
Correct.
For 12 or 18 years.
Correct. They're not even going for the 60, which I think the minimum is. And now the judge has to decide which avenue to drive in, and then he can take the mitigation and aggravation and figure out a number, which he probably has already figured out.
Yeah. If I had to be a betting girl, and I'm not, I would say that the judge, to try to kind of please both sides, would go with the aggravated battery somehow, but at a level to where the murder would just fold in.
I agree. I think he will take the side that will get him the best avenue on appeal. If he thinks it's the aggravated battery, that gives him a wide range. Even if you look at the 6 to 30, if you split it, well, half of 30 is 15, half of the 6 to 30 is whatever it is. I think it's 18, then he can go in that range and probably be fine with it.
All right, we're going to take another break. We could guess all day long. At the end of the day, it is up to Judge Gahan, but it's interesting to hear the legal arguments and to know it's not just a slam dunk in terms of a crime committed, and then here's your sentence. So again, an interesting look inside the courtroom for us to bring to you, and educational really for all of us, and that's the whole point of this. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back. Michael Oppenheimer, I'm Monica Schneider. We're bringing you inside the courtroom. The courtroom on recess right now in the sentencing hearing for former Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke, who was convicted of second-degree murder and aggravated battery in the shooting death 2014 of black teen Laquan McDonald. The first officer in Chicago in, I think, 50 years or something to be convicted in such a line of duty kind of thing. It has definitely put a mark on the calendar and on the city, and as we talked about earlier, as a result of all of this, the feds came in, the Justice Department came in and looked into the Chicago Police Department, and we're now involved in a consent decree situation where things are being mandated. Of course, you'd know more about this than I. With the change in administration, going from Obama to Trump, there's been some movement about whether or not the consent decree is needed, I believe, but what the feds have done is send in more prosecutorial help.
Correct.
So where do you kind of bridge that gap? I mean, do we not need reform of the police department, or we do? I mean, I think many people believe we do, but I guess the question is, do we need a federal sort of overlord on that?
I think under the Obama administration, when they did the DOJ report, it was pretty scathing. It cited a lot of our cases. It cited a lot of other cases. It was pretty scathing on the whole top-to-bottom reform. I think with Trump's DOJ, things changed a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So now I think we're getting a watered-down version of that. I think there's no question they need reform. And hopefully that will continue to happen. I think they've agreed to do things that will help. But it's on the lines of what you said, the training, the ingrained attitude, the ingrained tradition over X amount of years in this city, you know?
Well, and I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like, even with the best of training, to suddenly be in a situation. I mean, you would just think the training would be good enough, but you can train all day long, but I don't think it's the same as being in a live shooting scenario or where you might need to shoot, and then everything that would have to go through your mind. I can't imagine that. I mean, the only thing I could come close is when you're preparing to be a journalist and work on television before you ever go live, and then you do go live and you kind of lose your mind, but nobody's going to die in that scenario.
Correct. They have a dangerous job. The decisions they make are decisions that most citizens will never even consider in a lifetime. It's what to order for dinner. It's a lot of things like you said. So they have an incredibly tough job. But the best you can do is train them so these things then don't happen. And when they do happen, learn from them and grow from them and then take precautions and get rid of the bad apples. And this city has a history of not doing that.
Well, if we look specifically at this case and what the jury came back with, and again, I said throughout, because people were so divided, and I felt it was a personal responsibility in just anchoring this coverage, that I knew both sides were so divided. No matter what I said, people were going to take it, oh, as I'm on that side. And I replied to all those emails, as I pointed out earlier, trying to say, you know, it's important that we respect the process. So if you go into this, that those jurors made this decision and really thought it through, they didn't feel necessarily that Jason Van Dyke is necessarily a bad guy. They just felt he made a really bad decision. And so that takes you right back to, well, why did he make such a bad decision under pressure? Why did he, when all these other officers were standing down and waiting for a taser to arrive, why, in his mind, based on scanner traffic and everything, why did he suddenly, he saw somebody coming at him with a knife? And that's what, you know, the defense tried to point out. What goes through officers' mind? What's the training? What's this? What's that? And some things you probably do even subconsciously. We all do them. You walk forward, you walk backward. I think the jury gave some wiggle room there because they didn't say, they didn't go with first-degree murder when they explained it. But it clearly shows there's a need for more training or something that puts people in a scenario where they can react more deliberately in a thinking stance, and tasers would have been nice at that point if they didn't have to wait for them, which is a change that's happening.
I agree, and as what you said, many of these cases come down to you have all these other police officers out there. Police officers were following Laquan. They called for the taser. They were doing the right things. Laquan probably needed to be tased, and he probably needed to be taken into custody. But Van Dyke went rogue here, and nobody else is shooting. Some people didn't even have their guns out. We have other cases like that where 90% of the officers sometimes didn't even have their guns out, and then somebody comes up and shoots the guy. That is a problem. Training can help that. A lot of times in this city, and we have cases where they, not necessarily the Van Dyke case, but they knew the officer was a problem officer, yet they kept him on the force, and then later he goes ahead and shoots somebody or shoots two people. And so that's part of the problem with the department. They have to identify problems and they have to try and fix them. And in this case, you know, training. And maybe Van Dyke shouldn't have been on the street.
Well, again, and we were just seeing a bit of the video there that was the incriminating evidence all the way around. It was from the start when the public saw that video. They were just like, what on earth? What? Why? The defense made some very interesting arguments, showed its own recreation video that was actually, it was high tech, it was interesting, and you could even see from the officer's perspective that potentially the angles would show the teen coming closer, but as we pointed out earlier, it never showed the teen after raising the knife, which Van Dyke said he saw and his partner Joe Walsh at the time testified to. So there was no raising the knife. And that comes down to, again, if it's not a first-degree murder kind of thing where it's just so unjustified, I guess we all make mistakes in that we can perceive something to be something that it isn't. Our mind can play tricks. It's like you start seeing a hand swing, you think the next thing is happening. That's the only excuse I can give there to make any sense of it.
Sure, and that could happen. But in this case, a young man lost his life.
Exactly.
So it's a problem.
So therefore, it's second-degree murder in terms of what the jury said.
Correct.
You made a wrong decision.
Correct.
Based exactly on your circumstances,
correct,
no matter what you thought.
Exactly. And then he continued, although they're trained to eliminate the threat, he fired 16 times. And again, like you said, it comes down to the video. Not only did he keep firing, but he kept firing while he was down on the ground. And the prosecution did a good job of showing
blocks in time between those shots, so he could have stopped. When he's down on the ground, he wasn't getting up. And he was, you know, when Van Dyke got up there, and quite frankly, he lied. And he was a horrible witness when he said, I kept thinking, I just wanted to shoot that knife. That's insane. Number two, I thought he was going to get up and do something with that knife. It was a knife. He had shot him a bunch of times, and he was on the ground. So that was just a ludicrous argument, and that weighs on the jury. Either A, he wasn't prepped well enough, or B, the real answer is they should have known how he was going to act and shouldn't have put him on the stand. Now, it's his decision to go on the stand.
Well, I hate to sound so sort of cynical about this, but after watching, you know, the TV law shows, but then also watching cases and whatnot, everybody knows or seems to know that lawyers prep their clients for testimony, that they give them sample questions, they try to... And I heard a number of legal experts that I talked to, like just off camera, were just thinking, you know, I'm sure they prepped him, but he just was going to be who he was.
So I would agree
with Van Dyke, because he became combative with the prosecutor.
He did, right away.
It hurt him.
Right away. And so when you prep him, especially in this case, you not only prep him with you cross-examining him, you bring in 10 other lawyers to cross-examine, you bombard him. Your goal is to make it worse than it ever will be when he really hits the stand. In this case, the prosecutor only crossed him for about 10 minutes, 25 minutes, I think. I would have had him on the stand for a lot longer. Once he starts getting combative, it's only going to get worse for him, and you can really tear him up and step on his throat. They should have known how he was going to be on the stand. And most of the time, even though the jury wants to hear from the defendant, you don't put him on. And they understand that at the end of the day, that he doesn't have to take the stand. So it was a bad move putting him on. And that weighs on them.
Yet, from a layperson's perspective, you feel like if you don't hear from the accused, they're guilty, even though the law doesn't say that.
Understood. That's common sense and intuition, and a defense attorney struggles with that all the time. They want to hear from him. I know. What if I don't put him on? But I can tell you, and we don't win every case, but the majority of cases that we do and that we win, we don't put our guy on. You better be really confident how he's going to do, because the system does work. They don't hold you to, oh, he must be guilty for not putting him on. And you kind of explain that during the trial.
Well, this is all said and done. If they were to get another trial, what would you, for if it goes through appeal and then the appellate court were to say you get another trial, what would you foresee them doing? Strategy-wise.
They can do a couple of things. They can come to a deal, some sort of plea agreement, depending on what the sentencing is, and avoiding a trial for Van Dyke and putting the city through another trial. Because here we go again. The city does not want another trial. I doubt Van Dyke wants another trial, because you run the risk of getting him found guilty of murder, depending on
his sentence. Would he testify again on a new trial?
For me, there's not a chance in hell that I'd put him on. He will not testify. He ain't going to get back. So I would not put him on.
Jason Van Dyke, a case that has drawn national, even international attention. The 40-year-old former Chicago police officer wearing an orange prison jumpsuit before the
judge today. I believe we're hearing our Julian Cruz speaking there.
Since his October 5th conviction for the shooting death of Laquan McDonald, looking at a wide range of possible prison time, although Illinois law allows
the witnesses, not the family members, just the witnesses.
Mr. McMahon.
No objection. We'll join that motion, Judge.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen,
murder and 16 counts.
Good witnesses. Well, basically, what that means in the correct interpretation is that just means that they are asked to leave the courtroom. They are not asked or directed to communicate with each other. When you use the proper term about segregating the witnesses, then they're supposed to be kept separated and not communicating to each other about anything. So, sustained as to both parties. Thank you. All right. At this stage, we are in the aggravation phase of sentencing. Will you proceed, Special Prosecutor, Mr. McMahon?
Yes, sir. Mr. Vidal, Joy.
Could I have the attorneys over here, just Mr. Herbert, Mr. McMahon? yet. A little bit of confusion here. All right, all the witnesses going to be testifying are out of this courtroom. That's what it means for the motion to segregate the witnesses. All right, gentlemen, take care of your clients, witnesses. They can be put over, well, we got to keep them separated now. Ready, Jess?
Yes, Judge.
All right. Good, the door's closed. All right. Mr. Special Prosecutor Joe Cullum, will you proceed, please?
Your Honor, we would call Mr. Joy.
Come on out.
Have a seat, sir. The chair is adjustable. The microphone's live. Pull your chair up to the microphone, and if you feel comfortable, you can also adjust the mic. Speak into the microphone. Everybody will be able to hear your testimony, and it would be greatly appreciated. So thank you. Proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. So would you please state your full name, and can you spell your first name and your last name?
My name is Vidal Deshaun Joy. It's spelled V-I-D-A-L-E. Last name is Joy, J-O-Y.
Thank you. What is your occupation, sir?
I'm an published author and poet.
I want to direct your attention to August 10th of 2005 at about 10:50 p.m. Do you recall where you were at that date and time?
Yes, sir. I was at the gas station on Cermak. I was coming out the gas station.
So you were at the gas station on Cermak?
Yeah.
Cermak and what?
Ogden.
And were you in an automobile?
Yes, sir.
Were you a driver or a passenger?
Driver.
And was there anybody in the car with you?
Yes, acquaintance at that time. Yes, sir.
Okay. So you're in the car at about 10:50 p.m. What did you do?
About 10:50 p.m., I walked out the store, me and my acquaintance, got in my car, and I proceeded to pull out the gas station or what have you.
Onto the road?
Yes.
And when you pulled your car onto the roadway, what occurred?
As soon as I turned out the gas station, I got about 1,000 feet from the gas station, and I was abruptly pulled over by several squad cars.
When you got pulled over by the squad cars, how did you react? What did you do?
The first thing I did was pull over, place my hands on the steering wheel, and I looked to see the officer approaching. Officers approaching.
And after officers approached you, what happened?
Well, as the officers approached me, they came on both sides of my car. The defendant, Van Dyke over there, he approached my car with his gun drawn.
Okay, let me put it. When you say the defendant, do you see that person in the courtroom today?
Yes, I do.
Can you point to him and tell the court what he's wearing?
The gentleman's right there. He has on a gold, I guess it's Department of Corrections attire.
Your Honor, may the record reflect identification of the defendant?
The record will certainly will. The record will indicate an identification of the defendant.
Now, Mr. Joy, was the defendant in a police uniform?
Yes, sir.
Tell the court, if you would, what happened when the defendant approached you.
When the defendant approached me with his gun drawn, he was shouting obscenities, racial slurs, or what have you. And the defendant, as well as he was accompanied by several other officers who were shouting obscenities to my acquaintance as well.
Do you recall specifically what words the defendant used when he was yelling?
Well, honestly, I can't recall because I was quite nervous because he had his gun drawn on me.
How close did he get to you with his gun?
He put the gun to my temple.
And what was his tone of voice when he was yelling at you?
It was as if he was just infuriated, just out of his mind, in my opinion.
Now, after, how long do you think he had his gun up to your temple?
Basically, until he advised me to get out the car.
Did you get out of the car?
Yes, sir. I complied with everything he asked me of it. And I inquired him several times about, could I contact my attorney and what are you pulling me up? What am I being detained for?
And how did he respond when you asked him those questions?
He never answered it no more. He kept just verbally abusing me, basically. He never answered any of my questions. He never gave me any reasons for detaining me.
Did you, were you issued a traffic ticket?
Yes, sir.
Approximately how long were you detained on the roadway by the police officers?
To my recollection, it had to be like maybe 20 minutes or more.
Now, how did the incident that you just described affect you emotionally?
Honestly speaking, I do suffer from depression, and I have anxiety to the degree that any time that a police officer gets behind me, whether they're pulling me over or not, I become nervous. I get nervous to the point where I just shut down, to the point where I become momentarily catatonic.
Thank you. I have no further questions of the witness, Your Honor.
Cross-examination, Mr. Herbert.
How are you, Mr. Joy?
Under circumstances, I'm doing okay.
Okay. Let's talk about the circumstances. You're here to testify about your experience with Jason Van Dyke. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And how is it that you came to be notified about this?
I was contacted by the DA about maybe 40 days ago or more.
Okay. And was that the first time that you realized that Jason Van Dyke was the person that had pulled you over on that day?
Not at all. I somewhat followed the case, somewhat. However, I realized who he was, but I didn't think anything of it because when I first filed my grievance, it was abruptly dismissed.
Okay. And you, when you say your grievance, that means your complaint.
Yes.
Your complaint against Jason Van Dyke,
yes.
Correct?
Yes.
And that was filed with the
Office of Professional Standards.
Okay. And you spoke with them, correct?
Yes, sir.
And you told them everything that happened that night, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And you would agree with me that your memory was better back then than it is today, correct?
No, I wouldn't agree with you on that.
Is it your testimony that, do you remember when this incident took place, that you just testified to with Jason Van Dyke?
Yes.
When did it take place?
August the 10th, 2005.
Okay, so, and you gave a statement a few days after that to the Office of Professional Standards, right?
No, not a few days after that. I had a setup of, I went down to set up an appointment to be interviewed by a particular representative of the Office of Professional Standards to give my complete statement.
Okay. And you were allowed to give your complete statement, correct?
Yes.
And in your statement, you told them everything that happened on that day with Jason Van Dyke and the other police officers that pulled you over.
Yes, sir.
And would you agree with me that your testimony, or I'm sorry, that your memory about the incident was better back then regarding the events that occurred shortly before that, as opposed to today?
I guess that would be a fair assessment.
Okay. And you talked today about, you said that when you pulled out of the gas station, first of all, that wasn't your car, correct?
I had just purchased that for my stepfather.
Okay. But the car was not registered to you, correct?
Yes, it was registered to me at the time. I was just waiting for my particular tax to come back because it was registered in another state. It was registered in the state of Minnesota.
Right. And you didn't have the proper tags for your vehicle, correct?
At that time, no.
Okay. And those are the tags on the license plate, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And you, in fact, were given a ticket for that reason, correct?
Yes, which was immediately dismissed when I went to court because I proved that the car was registered in my name, in which I was never given the chance to explain that because Officer Van Dyke bum-rushed me.
Your case was dismissed because you actually had the registration at that point, correct?
The ticket was, yes.
Okay. On the day that you were driving this other person's vehicle that was registered to him, you did not have the tags on your vehicle, correct?
You're taking my statement because I did not say that. I said that the car was registered in my name. I was waiting on the tags. I had purchased that car previously from my stepfather.
My question was different, though, sir. My question was, on the day that you were driving this person's vehicle, the tags belonging to you, they were not on that car, correct?
That's incorrect. Okay.
Let's talk about your... you said multiple cars came pulling up on you, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Were you familiar with the area that you were in?
I live several blocks from that particular spot.
Okay. And you say several cars.
Excuse me?
You said several cars.
Yes.
Squad cars.
Yes.
Four or five squad cars?
Yes.
Okay. And they pulled up on your car specifically, correct?
They surrounded me.
Okay. And it looked like they believed that you were involved in some serious activity.
Yes.
Well, the answer will stand.
Okay. It didn't look like they were pulling you over for a traffic violation, right?
Well, yes. If that's your objection, overruled.
You remember the question?
No, repeat the question, please.
It didn't look like you were just getting pulled over for a traffic violation. It looked like they were pulling you over because they thought you were involved in something serious, right?
Basically.
In that area, you're familiar with it. It's a pretty rough area, right? There's some crime that's pretty notorious in that neighborhood.
That's Chicago.
I get you. Shootings? Okay. And you said that that Jason Van Dyke had his gun drawn. Did any other police officers have their gun drawn?
No, sir.
Okay. And you said that Jason Van Dyke was shouting at you, and you mentioned something about racial slurs.
Yes.
It's your testimony that Jason Van Dyke made a racial slur to you?
Yes.
Okay. What was that racial slur?
I was called a black-ass nigger.
And, of course, that offended you, correct?
Yes, it did.
Okay. And then when you went down to file a complaint against Jason Van Dyke, you never told the investigator that Jason Van Dyke called you those words, correct?
If you read the report, I stated that he used obscenities and racial obscenities towards me.
And you read that report and you signed it, correct?
Yes, I did.
And do you know, have you reviewed that report?
Yes, I have.
And when did you review that?
I reviewed that report this morning, yesterday, the day before that.
Okay. And where in the report does it indicate that you told the investigator that Jason Van Dyke made racial slurs against you?
Do you have a report in front of you?
I do. I'll mark this as...
Well, I don't necessarily have it in front of me, so I can't show you exactly where it's at because I don't have it in front of me.
Mr. Joy, looking at that report would be a little helpful for you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
I can have 1 minute.
Does anybody else have a copy of that report, so Mr. Herbert and Mr. Joy? Okay, go ahead.
I'm showing you what I've marked as exhibit number one. You recognize that document?
Yes, I do.
And that document is, in fact, the compilation of the complaint that you made against Jason Van Dyke, correct?
Yes, sir.
And that was made shortly after the incident, correct?
Yes.
And that was when the incident was more fresh in your mind than it is today, correct?
That's what you're stating, but it was a traumatic event. Therefore, I would never forget it.
Well, you would agree with me that in that statement, it does not contain any allegation made by you that Jason Van Dyke used a racial slur against you.
Well, the statement says, Joy related to the officer, the number one, that used profanities while telling him to get out of the vehicle, but he does not recall the words that were stated exactly. That's what it says.
My question, though, is there is nothing in that statement that you signed, correct?
Oh, okay.
You signed it, correct?
Yes, I did.
And in fact, you made some notations on there, corrections, correct?
Yes. Okay. And this is right there.
And nowhere in there does it contain any allegation made by you about a racial slur being used by Jason Van Dyke.
It depends on how you define profanities.
I'm asking racial slurs. This is single words.
In my opinion, the words profanities covers that.
My question, though, is different. Does it say racial slurs in that?
No, it doesn't say in the complaint.
Does it say the words that you testified Jason Van Dyke said, alleging the N-word? Is that?
Not this report.
And that's probably because it didn't happen, correct?
No, sir, because it did happen.
When you came here to testify today, you sat out in the room with some other people that were going to testify, correct?
Yes. Yes, that's why I was told to sit by everyone. I was told to sit by the officials or what have you.
And you guys were talking about your testimony today, correct?
Not about our testimony, no.
Okay, thank you. Finally, question about, you said he placed his gun to your temple. That was
yes.
Your testimony, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And if I can, you would agree with me that you never told the investigator from OPS, the complaint, shortly after this incident, you never told that person that Jason Van Dyke put a gun to your head.
Sir, I thought that him pulling a gun during a traffic stop was excessive enough.
Not my question. My question, though, is you came here today and you testified to the two worst things that Jason Van Dyke did. He used a racial slur against you and he put a gun against your head, correct?
Yes.
And you never told the investigator those two critical points that you're now here testifying to shortly after the incident happened.
I recall telling her, that doesn't mean she recorded it.
Well, you signed it, correct?
Okay.
And you made notations on there, correct?
That she asked me to make.
Okay. What are you putting there? Hey, you didn't put in here the two most salacious allegations I made, that Jason Van Dyke used the N-word against me, and he stuck the gun to my temple. Why didn't you include that?
Maybe because when I was being interviewed, that the interviewer acted like she was that she wasn't really interested in what I was talking about in the first place.
And she was a female there, correct?
Yes.
Minority, correct?
Yes.
Mr. McMahon, I'm sorry, Mr. Cullen. Mr. Joy, thank you.
Thank you.
Call your next witness, please.
The state will call Jeremy Mayers.
If they did not testify, they should go ahead. I thought you were going to sit in the court. All right, let's get a clarification. Once a witness testifies, what is the person calling that witness doing with the witness who testified? All right, are they separating them from the other witness? You're going to if they're contaminated, they won't testify. All right?
We're bringing Mr. Joy into the courtroom now that the testimony is complete, Judge, and he shouldn't be having contact with the other witnesses.
Thank you very much. That's great. Okay, good. Got that clarified. All the witnesses are going to be segregated. All the witnesses, after they testify, are going to be allowed into the courtroom. You got that?
Thank you. You.
Thomas, we're all firm that the testimony about to give should be the truth, the whole truth, and the truth, so you got it.
Yes, ma'am. Have a seat, sir. Thank you. The microphone's live. Your seat is adjustable. Pull your seat up to the mic. And then, good. Adjust the mic so that you can talk into it. And then everybody will be able to hear your testimony, and we would greatly appreciate that.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. All right. Proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sir, would you please state your first and last name and spell both for us?
Jeremy Mayers, Jeremy Mayers.
And how old are you, Mr. Mayers?
42 years old.
Mr. Mayers, I'd like to direct your attention to March 19, 2011. Mm-hmm. Were you living in the city of Chicago?
Yes, ma'am.
And on March 19, 2011, did you encounter an officer who had pulled you over in his traffic stop?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you see that officer in court today?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you point to that officer, tell us where he's seated and what he's wearing?
Yellow.
For the record, the witness is pointing to the defendant, Jason Van Dyke.
The record will indicate an in-court identification, counsel. Proceed.
Mr. Mayor, can you tell us what occurred during that traffic stop and your encounter with Officer Van Dyke at that time?
I was driving down Cottage Grove, 64th, and I was going straight. And excuse me, I'm a little nervous.
Okay. What kind of a car were you driving, sir?
A 74 Cadillac.
And what happened as you were driving your 1970?
Excuse me, state. Mr. Mayor, would you like some water?
Yeah, I'm a little nervous. Yes, sir.
Yeah, please.
Please.
Okay. Just take a couple breaths. There you go. Just give him a moment, state.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Let us know when you're ready to go forward, Mr. Mayor.
I'm ready.
Are you okay,
thank
sir?
You. Proceed, state.
Thank you, Your Honor. Can you tell us whether or not there was anyone in the vehicle with you when you were pulled over?
No, ma'am.
And what happened after you were pulled over?
I was pulled over when I was pulled over. I was pulled over and he pulled me over because he said I didn't make a turn signal, a left turn signal. I didn't use my signal.
I'm sorry, were you completed with your answers?
Go ahead.
How many officers were with Officer Van Dyke?
It was two other than him.
And he indicated to you that you didn't use the turn signal?
Yes, it went from I didn't use a turn signal, then it went from I didn't have a plate light or something. My plate light was out. And then it was, he said my pipes was too loud on the car or something like that.
What happened after you encountered the defendant and the other officers, and they advised you of these traffic violations?
I was asked to step out the car.
Did you comply with their request?
Yes, ma'am.
What happened when you were asked to step out of the car?
I stepped out the car. I think they smelled alcohol on my breath.
What happened? I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I'm listening.
What happened after you stepped out of the car?
I think when I stepped out the car, I think he gave me a breath of life. I mean, I did feel sobriety. Then they asked me to blow or something like that, and they searched my car and found the marijuana and all this stuff like that.
After your car was searched, what happened? What did they do with you, sir?
I think I got to feel sobriety because he smelled alcohol on my breath.
So after you did the field sobriety test, then what happened?
I said to him, my auntie is a commander and my cousin is a police investigator. I talked to him something like that. And from that point on, I just got arrested and he hauled me off to the police station.
And why did you say those? Why did you tell him about your arrest?
Because you know what, that night I had drunk a little bit. I was not intoxicated like that, but I drunk a little something.
And when you said they hauled you off, were you handcuffed?
Yes, ma'am.
And do you recall who handcuffed you?
Jason Van Dyke.
And after you were handcuffed, where were you seated?
In a police squad on a behind a passenger.
And where was Jason Van Dyke? Was he the driver of the squad car or the passenger of the squad car?
He was the passenger.
And did he sit in the front or in the back?
Did
Jason Van Dyke sit in the front seat of the squad car?
He was in the front.
Do you recall where you were taken after you were handcuffed and placed in the back of the squad car?
71st and Cottage Grove, 3rd District Police Department.
What happened to your vehicle after you were placed inside the squad car and handcuffed?
It was impounded.
Do you know how it was moved from the roadway?
Not one officer drove it away. I rode with him and his partner, some lady. I don't remember the lady.
When you say him and his partner, are you referring to the defendant?
Yes, ma'am.
And the female officer was the driver of the vehicle that you were riding
in?
Yes,
ma'am.
And then there was another officer that drove your vehicle?
Yes, ma'am.
What happened when you got to the police station?
Me and actually Van Dyke was in the car together, and I had a haul in my mouth.
When you say a haul, what are you?
A cough drop.
Where is the female officer?
She was walking toward the station. She was on the phone.
And so at that time, are you the only person in the squad car with Officer Van Dyke?
Yes, ma'am.
And you said you had a hawse in your mouth?
Yes, ma'am, a cough drop. And he told me to remove it, and I told him no.
What happened while you were alone in the squad car with Officer Van Dyke and you refused to remove the hawse cough drop from your mouth?
He turned around and started choking me, trying to get it out.
And when you say he turned around...
Because he was in the passenger seat. He turned around. I was cuffed like this in the back of the squad. And he told me to remove the cough drop, and I told him no, and he started choking me.
And were you able to breathe when he was choking you?
No, I mean, he was choking me enough. He stopped my breath a little bit. Yes, he did.
And how many hands did he use to choke you, if you remember?
He used his one hand like this.
For the record, taking his hand and placing it around.
Turned around, choking me like that.
After he had choked you, did you spit out the cough drop?
No, I didn't.
Did Van Dyke say anything to you?
No, we really didn't have any words like that, no.
Do you recall how long he choked you?
He choked me for a while, trying to get it out, maybe 5-10 seconds, something like that.
After he released you,
mm-hmm.
After Officer Van Dyke stopped choking you, what happened after that?
Then he removed me out the squad and took me in the station.
And did anything happen when you got inside the police station?
Yes, ma'am.
What happened?
When I got in the police station, they was trying to make me take the breathalyzer.
And when you say they, who are you referring to?
It was him and two other officers, a few other officers in the station.
So Officer Van Dyke and some other officers?
Yes, ma'am.
Who was administering the breathalyzer test to you?
I don't remember. I don't recall.
And did you take the breathalyzer test?
After the fourth time. They convinced me for three times. On the fourth time, that's when I blew exactly the legal limit, after the fourth try. After they forced me, basically.
When you say you took it four times, is that correct?
On the fourth time, I blew exactly the legal limit, ma'am.
So the prior three times when you took the breathalyzer...
It wasn't registered.
And who told you that? That it wasn't registering.
Nothing showed up.
And
I blew on the fourth time. That's when it actually read .08.
And you said they forced you. How were you
like
forced
kept,
to take
they,
it?
They not basically. Not basically for, go ahead.
Allow your wide latitude on cross examination. Overruled. Proceed, state.
You said you were forced to take it the fourth time.
I mean, they was convincing me like take it, like making me try to take it.
And did anything else happen when you were in that area of the police station taking the breathalyzer?
And now I can't recall too much. It's been so long.
Okay. So is your memory exhausted as to whether or not there was something else that occurred while you were taking the breathalyzer? You don't remember at this time?
Once I took the breathalyzer and blew the exactly legal limit, they was in the station like proud they got me and they booked me.
And did you at any time when you were at the police station request to speak to a supervisor?
Yes, ma'am.
And what was your purpose in making that request?
Because I want to file a complaint about what happened.
Did you, in fact, file a complaint about what happened?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you, were you interviewed by someone from the Independent Police Authority Board?
Yes, ma'am.
And when were you interviewed in relation to when you were arrested?
Maybe I was the same day, I think. Same day or the next day.
So you filed your complaint right away?
Yes, when I left the police, as soon as I got released.
Do you recall if you indicated in your complaint anything about...
State at this time. I'll just allow you wide latitude on cross-examination. Go ahead.
Did you indicate in your complaint...
I'm sorry, you can show him the complaint. Oh. If you, can, you know the rules of evidence.
Come yes. On.
To be announced. Take your time.
The statement that you provided to the Independent Police Review Authority Board?
Yes, ma'am.
And that's the statement regarding your encounter with Officer Van Dyke on March 19, 2011. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Now, sir, I'd like to direct your attention specifically to page 15 of that report.
Is hearsay allowed in this in a sense here? I'll allow you wide latitude on cross examination.
Sir, if you could review page 15.
Yes, ma'am.
Have you had a chance to look at page 15?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Myers, take a look at it. Make sure that you're comfortable with this. And then if you are comfortable, then not let the special prosecutor know that you are. Thank you.
Have you reviewed page 15 of that exhibit, sir? Now, you had indicated earlier that you didn't recall whether or not you had filed any other complaints with respect to Officer Van Dyke. After reviewing page 15 of People's Exhibit Number 1, is your memory now refreshed as to whether or not you made any other complaint regarding your encounter with Officer Van Dyke on March 19, 2011?
Yeah, when he twists my arm and stuff like that.
Did you file a complaint regarding Officer Van Dyke twisting your arm?
Yes, I filed a complaint on him choking me. That's what I filed a complaint about.
Did you also report to the independent police review authority that he had also twisted your arm?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you demonstrate to us how you described that Officer Van Dyke had twisted your arm?
When I was in the cuffs, taking the cuffs off, twisted my arm like that.
And after you had made your report to the Independent Police Review Authority Board, were you charged with any other offenses?
Yes, ma'am.
Were you ever ticketed for failure to signal?
Yes, ma'am.
And what about the loud muffler or loud pipes?
No, ma'am. I was convicted for the DUI, though. Yes, ma'am.
After you had made a report to the Independent Police Review Authority, did anything else happen with respect to the complaint you had made?
No, ma'am. They sent me a letter back maybe a month later, and they said they didn't find nothing he did was wrong.
How did that encounter with Officer Van Dyke impact you, sir?
You know what? I can't even look at the man right now. I just think of the night he choked me, and it just, he didn't have no remorse for nothing. I just can't look over that.
I'll let the officer stand, but again, I'll argue wide latitude on cross-examination.
Thank you, sir. Your Honor, I have no more questions. May I retrieve the exhibit from Mr. Mayors?
Mr. Myers, have a seat. Mr. Myers, sit here. Mr. Herbert, let the state sit down before you jump up, okay? Thank you. All right, now you can show a little courtesy. Cross-examination at this time, please.
Good morning, Mr. Myers. How are you?
How you doing, sir?
Good, thank you. So you were convicted of a DUI.
Yes, sir.
From the night that Jason Van Dyke pulled you over.
Yes, sir.
And you were impaired that night, correct?
Not really. I wasn't really impaired, but
did you plead guilty or were you found guilty?
Once you blow, I guess at the legal limit, I guess you're guilty, right?
So you pled
basically,
guilty.
Basically, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
You pled guilty to being under the influence of alcohol when you were driving, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's because you were under the influence of alcohol that night, correct?
Yeah, I had a... Yes, sir.
Okay. And this incident happened a long time ago, correct?
Yes, sir.
Do you remember how many years ago it happened?
2011.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And do you remember anything else about... Or do you remember the day that it happened?
March. I'm not sure the exact date. It's been a while, but I know it was in 2011.
Okay. Do you remember what day of the week it was?
No, sir.
Do you remember what you were doing prior to being pulled over by Mr. Van Dyke?
Yes, sir.
What were you doing?
I was leaving a friend's house. And
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I'm listening. I was leaving a friend's house. I was driving my old school Cadillac. I had just got some brakes done on the car. I was hanging out with the guys, had a drink with the guys. On my way home, leaving, like I said, coming up Cottage Grove, I'm driving in a straight lane. I'm just driving straight.
That's good. I'm not going to ask you about
okay,
that.
Okay,
I will, but I just
okay,
want to know
go ahead.
What you were doing prior to that. So you were drinking with your friends, correct?
Exactly.
And how many drinks did you have?
I didn't even have maybe a shot or something like that.
A shot of what? Whiskey?
No, vodka.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
And is it your testimony that's all you had
to yes,
drink
sir.
That evening?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
And when you blew your breathalyzer, you blew a .083. Is that correct?
.08, exactly, from my knowledge.
Okay.
Okay.
.08.
Yes, sir.
And your testimony is that you were a .08 blood alcohol after the arrest based upon that one shot of vodka, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And You were given, or you, I'm sorry, when you were stopped, you were told that you didn't use your turn signal when you changed lanes, correct?
Yes, sir, but I was going straight. I didn't have to use a turn signal.
And, but you were told that, correct?
Yes, sir.
And you were told that you that your plate light was out, correct?
Exactly.
And they told you that your muffler pipe was in excess of the legal limit.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And, in fact, you were given tickets for all of these, correct?
Yes, sir.
And, in fact, you pled guilty to all of these, correct?
I guess, yes, sir.
Okay. So you would agree with me that the reason for the stop was certainly lawful, correct?
Exactly, Bill. It was not a probable cause to stop me.
Okay. And then when they pulled you over, you said that they smelled alcohol on you, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And then you said that they found marijuana.
Yes, sir.
You said it was in the car, though, correct?
Yes, sir.
In fact, the marijuana wasn't in the car. It was on your person, right? It was in a pocket.
It was in the car on me. Same thing.
In the car or in your pockets, the same thing?
I mean, if I'm in the car when you search me, it's still on me, right? Right?
Are you asking me? I'm asking you. It was in your pocket,
it was
correct?
On me when not. Yes, it okay. was on me, I guess. Yes.
Okay. There were two other police officers with Jason Van Dyke that evening, correct?
Yes, sir.
And one was a female and one was a male, correct?
Exactly.
And in fact, you made a complaint against all three police officers for the actions that you've testified to today, correct?
I thought it was just against him. It's been so long, I thought it was just against him, sir.
Okay. Well, I'm telling you that you made a complaint against all three officers.
Maybe I did, sir.
And that was because you weren't sure exactly who did what to you, but knew it was... Let me finish the question just so it reads properly. But you knew that it was done by one of the three police officers that pulled you over.
No, I knew it was him. I knew his face clear as day. I knew it was him.
So your testimony is that Jason Van Dyke reached back and choked you for 5 seconds.
He choked me long enough trying to get that cough drop out of my mouth, sir.
Okay. And talking about the cough drop, you put that cough drop in your mouth, right?
Exactly, sir.
And you put that cough drop in your mouth after you were placed in handcuffs, correct?
Exactly, sir.
And you put that cough drop in your mouth because you knew you were arrested for DUI, correct?
Exactly, sir.
And you knew that you were about to take a breathalyzer test, and you knew that that would...
I could have refused the breathalyzer test, but they kept bugging me while I was in the station. I was there maybe 2 or 3 hours before I actually took the test.
Okay.
Thinking I wouldn't have never even took it if I would have knew that after a while the legal limit, I would have never took it. Because I thought since I'd been there 3 or 4 hours that it was going to be like nothing, it would have been gone. That's why I took the test.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you put the Halls in your mouth because you knew that that would influence the blood alcohol test, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
This you're familiar with. This wasn't your first time getting a DUI, correct?
No.
Overrule.
Okay.
Right.
Well, sir, this the thing is with this. The problem was
I
know
I. Question.
Okay, sir.
Okay.
Okay.
This was not your first time getting a DUI.
No, it was the second time, sir.
Well, in fact, you've been convicted 3 times, haven't you?
No, sir. No, sir.
Shows interest and bias. You really want me to lay everything out there, State?
No, sir.
How many have you been convicted of DUIs?
2, sir.
Okay. And one of them being this incident, correct?
Yes, sir.
Were there any marks on your neck from being choked?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And you made that complaint to the Office of Professional Standards, correct?
Yes, sir.
And they took photos of you, correct?
Yes, sir.
And they found that the photos didn't show any signs of...
Okay, but that's... Okay.
Yeah. Correct, right?
Okay.
Well, not okay. I want to make sure I understand your answer.
Yes, sir, but that don't defeat... He didn't choke me. So, okay then.
But they found that there were no signs of abuse to your neck, correct?
Exactly.
And that's because there wasn't any sign.
Okay, but that don't take away he didn't choke me, sir.
I understand.
Okay, then.
You agree with me, there was no sign.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And as far as the injury to your arm,
you demonstrated like a twist like that. Is that?
He twists my arm, taking off the cuff, sir.
Okay.
Okay? It's been so long, man.
You weren't injured from that, correct?
No, I wasn't, sir.
Yeah. In fact, you forgot all about that. You forgot all about that complaint until your Miss Height reminded you of it.
It's been
correct?
Over. You know how many years that's been, sir.
Okay.
Okay. I'm still dramatic about the guy choking me. Okay.
That choke has affected you for the rest of your life?
No. Every time I see him and what happened to what he did to the guy already, it's just. I'm traumatized by what happened
in
this case.
When you say the guy, you're talking about the shooting death.
Yes.
And that's why
it could have been prevented.
And that's why you're.
It could have been prevented, sir. Could have been prevented.
Anything else? Thank you. Myers? Thank you very much. You can step out. Take all your next witness.
Sir, the chair is adjustable. The microphone's adjustable. Pull your seat up to the mic, adjust the mic, speak into the mic, and everybody will be able to hear your testimony, and we would greatly appreciate that. Proceed.
Thank you. Sir, would you state your name and spell your first and last name for the court report?
My first name is Eric. My last name is Breathitt. My first name is spelled E-R-I-C. My last name is spelled B-R-E-A-T-H-E-T-T.
And, sir, how old are you?
I am 28 years of age.
And what do you currently do for a living?
I am an employee at Ford Motor Company.
And how long have you worked for Ford Motor Company?
3 years.
Now, directing your attention back to July 14th of 2009, you would have been approximately 18 years old?
Yeah, as you said, what year again? I'm sorry.
2009.
2009. I should have been 19 at the time.
Okay. And do you recall an incident that occurred when you were driving that day?
Yes.
Okay, so you recall that incident?
Yes, ma'am.
And what kind of vehicle were you in?
I was driving in a 2002 Monte Carlo SS.
And was that your car or somebody else's car?
My vehicle.
Was there anybody else in the vehicle with you?
Yes, ma'am.
And was that how many people?
One.
Now, where were you traveling?
I was traveling eastbound on 79 going to Rainbow Beach.
And how far is Rainbow Beach from 79th?
I couldn't actually give you any specifics on that. It's probably going to be probably an extra 6 to 7 minute drive from 79th to Stony Island.
Okay. And you call approximately what time of day it was?
It was more so approaching the evening time, if I'm not mistaken. Definitely, because I got out of lockup later that night. It was more so during the evening time.
And as you were driving on 79th Street, what happened?
Traveling eastbound on 79th Street, there was a car club traveling in front of me. I guess you can say a mixed breed car club. Several cars, loud music, in and out of traffic, lane swerving. From this point, me and my girlfriend at the time, we identified that and we did not want to have any parts of that. So we decided to put 3 to 4 car lengths in between us and the car club. From this time, I seen a squad car heading westbound on 79th Street, going in the opposite direction in which we were going. They went approximately about a block to 2 blocks from that point, and then they made a U-turn, which I did. I was able to capture in my rear view. And, you know, instantly me and my girl suspected that the car club that was in front of us was about to be penalized for the reckless driving, the loud music, and the things of the nature.
Okay, and so this squad car got behind you?
Yes, ma'am. The squad car then got behind me. I looked in the review. Once he got behind me, I thought I could have possibly slightly rolled through a stop sign. However, just a young black man in America, I've always feared for my life when a CPD or any police officer gets behind me. So,
can you just tell us what happened? Okay.
Yeah, definitely. So, like I said, I feared.
Okay. Did you get pulled over?
Yes, I thought I got pulled over.
And did you get pulled over by the officer putting lights on the squad?
Yes.
Okay. Were there any sirens or just lights?
I can't recall. Okay. I know there were definitely lights.
Did you immediately pull over?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And is how many? Strike that. Did any officers get out of the squad?
I'm sorry.
Did any officers get out of the squad car?
Yes, ma'am.
How many?
Two.
And besides that squad, were there any other squads that responded to the scene?
Not that I can recall.
Okay. And did the officers approach your car?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you tell us what happened as the officers approached your car?
Once they approached my car, I let my window down. I asked, what am I being stopped for? And they say, you know what you're being stopped for. So, you know, I kind of laughed it off because, you know, of course, I just definitely just rolled through a stop sign, a stop and roll through the stop sign.
Did you know the names of the officers as you sit here today?
I'm sorry?
Do you know the names of the officers that stopped you?
I know the name of the... I definitely know the name of the officers. Not the full name for the first one, but I do address them as Officer Du Bois. We only have the last name. And,
Sir. The answer is yes or no. Do you know the names? Do you know the names?
Yes.
Okay. And so what were the names of the two officers that
Officer Du Bois and Officer Van Dyke.
Okay. Do you see Officer Van Dyke in the courtroom?
Yes.
Would you describe something he's wearing for the record?
He's definitely in his he's definitely in the right attire. He's in a county fit.
Okay. Your Honor, would the record reflect in court identification?
Record so reflect.
Now, sir, who approached on the driver's side?
On the driver's side, Officer Du Bois approached me.
Okay. Did you see where Officer Van Dyke approached you?
Yes, he approached me approached my vehicle from the right side of the vehicle.
Okay. And then were you asked to get out of the vehicle?
Yes, ma'am, after some time.
And did you get out of the vehicle?
Yes.
Okay. And as when you got out of the vehicle, where did they have you go?
They actually placed me in handcuffs and set me in the back of the squad car.
Okay. And as you were put into handcuffs, what were they doing?
Going through my vehicle, trying to pry open my trunk.
And do you know why they were trying to pry open your trunk?
Well, from the initial reasons of being pulled over, they told me that I was being pulled up for a DTP sound violation.
What's a DPT?
DTP, disturbing the peace, a sound violation.
Okay.
Okay.
Did you have any sound coming out of your car as you were driving on 79th Street?
No, ma'am. No radio face was present or energized at the time.
So, did you explain to the officers that you weren't playing your radio?
I explained to the officers that I was not playing my radio, and the equipment that I did have in my vehicle was not even connected.
Okay. What equipment did you have in your vehicle?
I had subwoofers in my vehicle.
And where were they at?
Located in the trunk.
Okay. And they weren't connected?
They were not connected.
Did you have a conversation with Jason Van Dyke at the scene?
Van Dyke, it was more so back and forth between him and the officers on what was going on, and basically what was going to happen to me if I didn't admit to having music on. It was just basically unprofessional.
And so did you ever admit that you had your music on?
No, ma'am.
And then what happened?
Seeing how I did not admit to having a music on, they questioned me about shootings in the area, and after that they further said, if you don't admit, we're going to take you to jail anyway.
Did you get arrested and taken to jail?
Yes, ma'am.
And do you call what district you were taken to?
I'm not absolutely sure of the district, but it was on 103rd.
Okay. And what, if any, ticket were you given?
I believe it was a license plate ticket, and then I had to sign for once I got once I bonded out of jail, I had to sign a ticket contesting to the faith of the actual music being played just to be released.
Okay. And did you have any medical condition as this was going on that night?
Yes, ma'am. This was the summertime. He placed me in the back of his squad car where I was already fearing. I've asked for my inhaler several times due to my asthmatic condition that I have.
Okay. And were you having an episode?
I definitely was having an asthma, I'm not going to say a pure asthma attack, but I was having an episode where I couldn't really get my breathing under control due to the fact of being scared and not knowing what was going on.
Okay, and did anybody ever give you your inhaler that night?
I was denying my inhaler.
After you were taken down to the station, you ended up getting released, is that correct?
I'm sorry?
After you were taken to the station, you ended up getting released?
Yes, they told me if I signed a ticket that I would be able to be freed that night.
And how long were you actually at the station?
Probably about an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Okay. At some point, did you then file a complaint?
Definitely did, ma'am.
And how long after the incident did you file a complaint?
It was probably right away. Probably within the next day or so.
And you were interviewed about that, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Did you ever get any kind of notification as to what happened to your complaint?
To be honest with you, I filed several complaints against CPD for insufficient behavior, and I couldn't tell you which one. I believe the last complaint I got was for something not pertaining to the case I actually had, with the incident I actually had with Van Dyke and Mr. Du Bois.
Okay. Thank you.
Cross-examination, Mr. Herbert.
The last point you made, I just was unclear on that. You talked about that you filed a complaint, and I thought you referenced that you filed a different complaint on a different incident.
Yes.
Okay. And when did you, that was against other police officers, correct?
Yes, against another officer.
Okay. Not related to Jason Van Dyke at all?
No, sir.
Okay. And did you make that complaint before or after you made the complaint to Jason Van Dyke? Do you remember?
This was years later. Okay. 2014, to be exact, February 14th, is when the incident took place. I filed a complaint the very next day for that officer. But I know we're not here about that officer right now.
Right. We're here about Jason Van Dyke.
Yes, sir.
And when you pointed to Jason Van Dyke, you chuckled and said something about him wearing being in the right clothes.
Yes.
Remember that?
Yes, definitely.
And by that you meant he's wearing prison clothes, correct?
Yes, definitely.
And you think he belongs in prison, right?
Yes, definitely.
And because you've seen the video?
Video?
Yeah.
No.
Have you seen, you know why he's in prison, don't you?
Of course.
Okay, you've seen that, the video of Laquan McDonald being shot?
No, sir.
Okay. So you haven't seen the video, but you still believe that Jason Van Dyke belongs in prison. Is that your testimony?
Due to his behavior, yes, sir.
Okay. To his behavior towards you?
Due to his behavior and his, I guess I could say, due to his behavior characterized in what he's in as for his profession. He's a police officer. He was, at the time, was a police officer, but was not, displaying an act of justice at the time. It's just pure chaos.
Okay, and just so I'm clear, when you're talking about Jason Van Dyke not acting within his profession,
yes,
you're talking about the incident involving you with Jason Van Dyke?
Yes.
Okay, and you believe you should be in jail for that?
Yes.
Fair to say you don't have a high opinion of police officers, correct?
I do have a, you guys serve the law. I definitely have a high opinion of police officers.
Hey, I don't serve. I'm not a policeman, but
I'm on the podium at the moment, sir.
Okay. Young black man in America, and that's why you believe you were pulled over by Jason Van Dyke, correct?
A young black man in America, the reason I'm being pulled over. I guess you can say.
Well, that's what you said earlier today. When you saw them behind you, your first thought was, young black man in America, that's where I'm getting pulled over.
Yeah, definitely. America has its history. I'm not going to sit up here and restate the facts about what America's done.
Yeah, and I'm not going to disagree with you on that.
Yeah, definitely.
My point is, you think that police mistreat young black males especially on a frequent basis. Fair to say?
It's fair to say that in certain neighborhoods and certain areas, yes.
Okay. And just coming to a close here, you thought that you might have rolled through a stop sign, that's why you were pulled over?
Yes.
Do you know if, in fact, you did roll through a stop sign?
I don't think I actually rolled through the stop sign.
Okay.
Like I said, I instantly got scared. You see the police, you instantly get scared. You don't know what the outcome can be. Even if you're innocent or guilty, you don't know what the outcome can be with CPD, and it has been proven in the past.
Yeah, and that's why you make complaints, right?
Yes, definitely.
And when you made the complaint to about Jason Van Dyke, you made the complaint about Jason Van Dyke as well as his partner, correct?
Yes.
And you complained about, you alleged that Van Dyke and his partner pulled you over for no reason, correct?
Yes.
And you allege that Van Dyke and his partner denied you your inhaler, correct?
Yes.
And you allege that Van Dyke and his partner used verbally
abused me during the... Yes.
Okay. And that's because at the time, you really weren't sure who did it, which officer. It was either Van Dyke or his partner, right?
I'm sorry. I'm confused with the question.
Okay.
And when you say what officer did what?
I'll ask a different question because it probably wasn't a good one. But you made a complaint against two police officers that pulled you over, correct?
Yes, sir.
And you didn't make a specific complaint against Jason Van Dyke. It was a general one against the two police officers that pulled you over.
I judged them as a group. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
No problem. State, call your next witness, please.
State, call Edward Nance.
Nance.
Attorneys over here for a second. Yeah, go ahead, please. Thank you.
testimony you're about to give to be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, God. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Nance, just have a seat, please. All right, pull your chair up to the microphone. Then you can adjust the microphone, all right?
Yes.
All right. And speak into the microphone. Proceed, Mr. Nance.
Thank you, Judge. Mr. Nance, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions here, okay? I want you to start by stating your name for the court reporter. She's right in front of you there. What's your first name? Mr. Nance?
Mr. Nance, you're having a hard time right now.
Edwin Nance.
Would you spell your last name, please, for the court reporter?
N-A-N-C-E.
And Mr. Nance, how old are you?
49.
And I want to talk to you about the night of July 9th, 2007. Okay? It's a long time ago, but you remember that night, correct?
Yes.
You remember? You were driving a car, correct?
Yes.
Whose car were you driving?
My mother's.
And what kind of car was that?
07 Cutlass, 07.
That's okay. It was a 2007 Oldsmobile Cutlass?
Yes, Oldsmobile Cutlass.
And you had one passenger with you?
Yes.
And who was the passenger?
Carlton Robinson.
And Carlton is?
My cousin.
Your cousin, yes. Right? Did you pick Carlton up?
Yes.
And where'd you get
this? This is preliminary, all right? And there's witnesses having a little bit of difficulty, so certainly Mr. McMahon can lead up until the point where it's critical, all right? Go ahead.
Where did you pick Carlton up from?
The Dan Ryan.
Could you say that again, please? I couldn't hear you.
At the Dan Ryan on 87th Street.
Okay. And was he working, or did you pick him up from his home?
No. He was coming to visit me. He was coming from the west side to visit me.
So you picked him up. He gets in the car that you're driving, which is your mother's.
Yep.
And where were the two of you going?
Back to my house in Marinette.
Okay. As you were driving back to your home with your cousin, what happened?
We got to King Drive at the red light, and the red lights flashed behind my car. The light turned green, and I went across the light, and I stopped right there, like two vehicles down past the light.
And why did you stop?
The police officer had the lights on my car.
So the police officer activated his lights. You pulled over within two car lengths of him turning his lights on.
The light turned green, and then I went across the light and pulled over right there.
Okay. You're driving your car?
Yes.
And your cousin was where was he located?
The passenger seat next to me.
Right next to you, the front seat passenger.
Front seat.
Did police officers approach your car?
Yes.
Did they walk up on foot?
Yes.
How many?
Two at first.
What happened after those two police officers walked up to the side of your car?
He tried to open my door.
Now, when you say he, who are you talking about?
Jason Van Dyke.
I'm going to ask you, you see Jason Van Dyke in the courtroom today. I know you don't want to look around, but I need you to look around.
Yes.
And would you describe what he's wearing?
This shirt, yellow shirt.
Yellow shirt? Did you say yellow shirt?
Deputy Patrol Officer.
Yes.
Your Honor, the record would reflect the in-court identification of the defendant, Jason Van Dyke, wearing a yellow shirt.
Record so reflect, Counsel.
What did Mr. Van Dyke say or do when he reached your car door?
Open his motherfucking door.
Did you respond?
Yeah, I rolled my window down some, and I just asked him what he stopped me for.
Did he respond?
He's open his motherfucking door right now.
Did you open the door?
No.
Are those the first two things that you heard the defendant say to you as he approached the car?
Yes.
So that's how he greeted you?
Yes.
After he said this the second time, did you open the door?
No.
Did you respond verbally?
No, I tried to ask him I let him put it down, and I had my license in my hand. I was trying to let him know that if you need my license or something, what'd you stop me for?
And did he tell you what he stopped you for?
No.
What happened after that?
The police officer on the other side of the car started trying to open another door, and then I guess my cousin unlocked the doors.
Okay, you had electric locks in that car?
Well.
And when the doors were unlocked, what happened after that?
He opened the door and pulled me out of the car.
Who's he?
Jason Van Dyke. Okay.
How did he pull you out of the car?
He grabbed my arm and pulled me out.
What happened to you when the defendant pulled you out of the car?
He pulled me out of the car and grabbed my left arm and slung me around the car. And threw me face first on the car, and then put a handcuff on my arm, and then he grabbed my other arm, and he pulled it around and put the handcuffs on both my arms.
After he put handcuffs on both of your arms, what happened after that?
He said, "What the fuck is wrong with you, motherfucker? I told you to get out the car." And I asked him, "What you stopped me for?"
Did he respond?
Yeah, he said something. But after that, he turned me over and slammed me face first onto the car. And that's when they started taking my cousin out of the car.
I object to discussions about
the day. Is there any doubt in your mind he's only talking about two people there? Huh? Two police officers.
He just identified people who were not infected.
That's the purpose of cross-examination. Overrule.
So let me just ask you another question, Mr. Manson. The defendant yanks you out of the car, slammed you face down on the back of your car, handcuffs both of your hands behind your back, and he flips you over.
And threw me back on the car, my back first.
And what did the defendant say or do to you after he turned you around and slammed you on your back, on the back of your car?
He said, "Don't move, motherfucker, just don't move." And then that's when they started messing with my cousin.
Did the defendant stay with you when they then started to mess with your cousin?
I think so, because when he had me, the other officer had Carlton, and that's when he grabbed me by my arms and started dragging me around the car toward the police car at that point.
Okay. So I want to ask you about that, okay? So you're still in handcuffs. You're bent over backwards on the back of your Oldsmobile. You're then taken from that location by the defendant, Jason Van Dyke, to the police car.
Yes.
You're still in handcuffs?
Yes.
What happens when you are taken to the police car?
He drugged me I was walking backwards. He drugged me backwards toward the police car.
Your handcuffs are located, or your hands are handcuffed. Are they in front of you or behind you?
Behind me. The handcuffs were behind me, and he was dragging me. I was walking backwards. He was dragging me backwards.
And he took you where?
To the police car.
When you got to the police car, what happened there?
He threw me in between the back of the front seat and in front of the back seat and put me on the floor in front of the back seat, in the back seat, on the floor.
You're still in handcuffs?
Yes.
And your hands are cuffed behind your back?
Yes.
Did the defendant put you face down or face
yes,
up?
Yes, face down.
Okay. Were your feet, was your entire body within the squad car at that point?
No, he had to push me in. I couldn't fit. I was talking about it hurts, and it, I couldn't move, and no, he had to push me further. I was across the floor of the back seat, across the seats, on the floor, not on the seat.
But the defendant, Jason Van Dyke, pushed you all the way in
yes.
to the squad car on the floor while your hands were cuffed behind you.
Yes.
Were you in pain, physical
yes.
pain when that happened?
Yes.
Where were you feeling pain?
My arms.
And would you describe that pain? Was it severe? Was it minor? How bad was that pain?
I didn't know what had happened to my arms, but I was, it hurt very bad. You know, I couldn't move my shoulders, and I couldn't move nothing.
Did you tell the defendant that you were
yes.
in pain and he was hurting you?
Yes.
Did he respond?
He said, shut up and lay down.
Did you fight back against
no,
the defendant when he told
you? I couldn't.
Okay. What happened after that?
They closed the police car, and about 20 minutes, 30 minutes went by, and the door opened again, the back door opened.
Did you see someone when the door opened? Or
I couldn't see nobody. Okay. I was face down. I didn't see nothing.
What happened after the door opened?
He tried to lift me up, and I kept telling him, you can't lift me up because it hurt.
How did he try to lift you up?
But he grabbed my arm, and then so I tried to let him know that it hurt, but it was like he didn't care. So when he tried to pick me up, he couldn't pick me up. So I was like, you got hurt. You can't do that. So I guess. He moved me, he pulled me back, and he tried to sit me up on the seat, and then he pulled me out of the car by my left arm.
Did he get you out of the car?
I got out of the car eventually, yes.
When he got out of the car, what did the defendant say to you?
Come here, get over here. And I asked him, I said, what happened to my car? Where's my cousin at? And
did the defendant respond to you?
Yes.
What did he say?
He said, shut the fuck up.
20 minutes earlier, or about 20 minutes earlier, you were taken out of your Oldsmobile.
Yes.
Was the Oldsmobile still
no.
located
there? No. The car was gone and my cousin was gone.
Did the defendant tell you where your car was?
No.
Where your mother's car was?
No.
Did the defendant tell you where your cousin was?
No.
You asked about both your car and...
I asked him where my cousin went. Where was my cousin? Where was my mom's car?
And did the defendant respond when you asked those questions?
He said, shut the fuck up or you gonna go to jail.
What happened after that?
He took the handcuff, he put me back on the street side, on the south side of the street, in front of the police, on the side of the police car. Took the handcuffs off my arms and pushed me in the back and told me to get out of here and go home.
What'd you say after that?
I started walking, and I said, wait, can I have my license? Where's my license at? And he said, shut the fuck up or you're going to go to jail. I said, can I have my license? He said, say one more motherfucking word. And he said, matter of fact, stay right there. Don't move.
What happened after that?
He left, went to the police car. He came back maybe 5 minutes later and gave me a ticket.
What did he give you a ticket for?
I don't know why he gave me a ticket. He gave me a ticket for, the ticket was for, no front license plate on the front of my car. He never even saw the front of my car.
The first time you saw the defendant, I want to go back, before you got pulled over, you saw the squad car. It was a marked squad car.
Correct? Yes.
Light bar up on top of the vehicle?
Yes.
And you saw that vehicle before you were actually pulled over, correct?
Before
he pulled you over, you saw that?
Yes.
Car. Where was that car in relation to you before he pulled you over?
Right behind my car at the red light, at facing eastbound at the King Drive light on 87th Street.
Traveling the same direction?
Yes.
But behind you?
Yes.
So he writes you a ticket for no front license plate after this incident that you just described what he did to you?
Yes.
Any other tickets?
No.
After the defendant wrote the ticket, he handed it to you?
Yes.
Did he say anything to you when he handed it to you?
Get the fuck out of here. Don't say nothing else or you're going to go your ass to jail. Go home.
What'd you do?
I walked away.
Where'd you walk to?
East on 87th Street.
Did you eventually go home?
Yes.
Was your cousin at home waiting for you?
No.
Did you have any other contact with the defendant either that night of July 9th, 2007, or maybe into the early morning hours of July 10th?
No.
Last time you saw him?
Yes.
Well, not the last time you saw him. That's the last time you saw him that night, correct?
Yes.
Did you go to court for that no front license plate ticket?
No, I did not go to court for the ticket. The ticket was thrown out.
Okay. Did you get your mother's car back?
No, never got my mother's car back at all.
Did your mother get her car back?
No, we never got the car back.
I want to ask you about your injuries. You felt pain in your shoulders immediately when the defendant did these things to you that you just described.
Yes.
Did that pain last?
Yes.
Did the pain continue?
Yes.
Did you eventually see a doctor for the pain?
Yes.
Did you receive medical treatment for the pain?
Yes.
Did you have to have surgery for your injuries?
Yes.
When did you have that surgery? Just about, Mr. Manson.
I had the surgery toward the end of 2007 for my left shoulder, rotator cuff. That was the first one. And then I had to have surgery 6 months later, 5.5 months later, for my right shoulder, rotator cuff.
Before July 9th, 2007, when the defendant did these things to you, throwing you in the back of the squad car, did you have shoulder injuries or did you have shoulder pain before that?
No.
Did you have any other physical injuries that you suffered as a result of what the defendant did to you on July 9th, 2007?
Yes.
What are those other injuries?
I had a surgery, the orthopedic surgery, on my left rotator cuff shoulder first. I had the rotator cuff surgery on my right shoulder after that. I was off work for like less than 2 weeks from for less than 2 weeks in a year. I had to go back to work. The other injuries, my neck and my shoulder, my neck and both my shoulders and my arms, it hasn't ever stopped. I had a second surgery on my left shoulder in July 2016. It was more invasive this time. They had to cut under my arm, take a ligament out of there to put back where the initial surgery was done to repair it again. They cut here under my arm, then they cut on top of my shoulder this time and put the ligament from under my arm to on top of my shoulder inside my arm, my shoulder. I have to have surgery again on my right shoulder again now. You're talking about just the physical pain or everything else?
I want to talk to you about the physical pain first, okay, and then we'll go to other stuff. But you've had three surgeries on your shoulders.
Mr. McMahon, at this time, I have to interject. Are you going to bring a doctor in to say that there's a causal connection that this happened?
No, Judge.
All right, then move on then.
Mr. Nance, you've experienced emotional pain, psychological pain as well, correct?
Yes.
Okay. How have the actions of Jason Van Dyke on July 9th affected you emotionally?
I can't sleep at night. I sleep for about an hour and a half, and I get up, and I eventually try to go back to sleep. I got anxiety and PTSD. I had brought back a lot of stuff, and ADD. I can't focus on nothing. It brings back a lot of stuff. I just try to deal with it. I see a couple of psychiatrists, one at the VA, one outside the VA. I see a couple of psychologists to talk to them. I got biofeedback at the VA. I got I take hydrocodone for the pain. I take ibuprofen for my pain. I take a muscle relaxer. I take an anxiety pill twice a day. I take a depression pill twice a day. I take a ADD pill three times a day.
Mr. Nance, we're almost 11 years after this incident happened that you just described. You still experience physical pain?
Yes. I can't move my shoulders.
And that's on a daily basis?
I can't lift 10 pounds on my left arm. I can barely lift my right arm. I can't referee no more. I was a referee for the state. I was going to go to the MAC conference.
I'll let this go. You can, again, wide latitude on cross-contamination. Go ahead, Mr.
You were a high school referee, or what level?
High school referee, JUCO.
JUCO and, junior college?
Junior college, basketball and football. And I can't referee no more. I was a good official. It hurt when I lift my arms over my shoulders. I can't kill the clock the proper way. When you killing the clock for football and basketball, but for football, I'm in constant pain every day.
Mr. Nance, you filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against
Yes.
defendant in the Chicago Police Department, correct?
Yes.
And that case You were represented by a lawyer in that case, right?
Yes.
Overrule. Go ahead.
File a federal civil rights claim.
Be a little more concise.
In 2008, you filed a civil rights claim against defendant Jason Van Dyke, the city of Chicago, and some other members of the Chicago Police Department, correct?
Yes, sir.
And the basis of that lawsuit were...
You have a continual objection. Thank you.
Were the events of July 9th, 2007 that you just described, correct?
Yes.
That case preceded a trial?
Yes.
And there was a verdict in your favor in that case?
Yes.
That was a jury trial?
Yes.
Is that a yes?
Yes.
I'm almost done. Mr. Nance, in addition to the federal civil rights claim lawsuit that you brought, you filed a complaint with the Independent Police Review Authority, didn't you?
Yes.
The Independent Police Review Authority took no action against Mr. Van Dyke.
No. He went to work the same day, the next day of day, like nothing happened.
Thank you, Mr. Nance. That's all I have.
Mr. Nance, listen to me. Would it be Mr. Nance?
Oh, my God.
You want to take a little bit of a break right now? Or you want to go on?
I need a napkin and some water.
We'll get you some water. Don't worry about that. Do you feel good enough to go on then?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Cross-examination, Mr. Hurley.
Thank you.
Okay, how you doing, Mr. Nance?
Is a pizza coming? I'm going to take a break after you take a
break. Mr. Nance, you're very emotional, and I don't want to... I'm not casting any aspersions on your emotion, but my question is, did you take all that medication that you spoke of? Did you take that today before you testified?
I took an anxiety pill about when we first got here, so because when I walked in, I didn't want to.
How many pills did you take today?
I take my anxiety pill, the clonazepam, and I took an ADD pill. I had took half of an ADD pill, and okay. I took a half of a hydrocodone for my shoulders.
And is that a dose that you normally take, or did you take more because you were coming in here to testify?
No, I had to calm down. The anxiety pill helps me calm down. The ADD pill helps me focus, and the pain pill is for the pain.
Okay. So the medication that you took that for anxiety and the ADD, you took that because you were coming in here to testify today, correct?
I took it because I got emotional outside talking to the young lady that brought me in, talking about what I had to do today and coming here today.
Okay. Is this a normal occurrence for you to be this emotional?
Stressful times, yes.
Stressful times in your life, correct?
Well, every day, I take the same pills once or twice a day, depending upon the dosage and the frequency that I have to take them.
And you talked about some of your conditions, anxiety, PTSD, ADD. You've been diagnosed with those from before your incident with Jason Van Dyke, correct?
No.
Is it your testimony that what Jason Van Dyke did to you resulted in you having ADD?
Yes.
and PTSD. You had no symptoms of PTSD prior to the incident with Jason Van Dyke. Is that your testimony?
20 years ago, I was in the Army. I enlisted in the Army. Something happened to me when I first got to the Army in 88. But I wasn't taking medication for it at all until after this incident with Jason Van Dyke.
Okay. But you were, as a result of the incident, what happened at the Army?
At a blanket party. They call it a blanket party. I was a short guy in 88. And cats tried to give me a blanket party, and then a couple other guys saved me. Tommy McSwain and James Dixon, two buddies I had in the Army, they stopped him.
They stopped the physical beating that you got? Answer, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Okay. So you were beaten by these men.
They tried to...
Just let me finish. In this blanket party is the way you described it, correct?
No.
You were beaten by men that night?
No.
Mr. Nance, were you ever beaten at all at that blanket party?
No.
Okay, move on.
Okay. You were discharged from the Army as a result of that incident, correct?
No.
That incident, you were treated for that incident, correct?
No.
Is your testimony that you never received treatment, psychological treatment, as a result of that incident?
No.
Just having a bit of technical difficulty with our feed coming in from the courthouse. As we're listening for the Van Dyke sentencing hearing to resume, this has been very compelling testimony by this man, Edward Nance, who filed a civil lawsuit against the police department and Jason Van Dyke some years ago and was awarded $350,000. But it is his contention, and records indicate that Van Dyke was never punished in any way for the beating that Nance underwent. Again, awarded $350,000, but there was never any evidence or any kind of citation or other punishment wielded to Jason Van Dyke. And this man is also reported as having said that after he heard about the Laquan McDonald shooting, that why had only something been done about this officer in the past. So this is Michael Oppenheimer with us, with Erickson and Oppenheimer, a law firm here in Chicago, handles criminal defense and civil rights cases. This is compelling stuff, but we never heard any of this at trial, not at Jason Van Dyke's trial for murder. We didn't hear any prosecution witnesses talking about what we're hearing today, basically talking about police brutality, racial profiling. A best guess as to why they wouldn't have been at the trial?
So, A, they had make a decision not to try and bring this in because it might affect, it's too prejudicial to the jury. So the judge, A, may have kept it out if they tried to bring it in. If they didn't try to bring it in, that was a strategy decision. This has gone on, but this is effective stuff. They're bringing a racial profiling, driving while black, calling someone the N-word, a beating where there was a judgment against them. That is powerful stuff against Jason Van Dyke, and the judge could have decided that it's too prejudicial, or they didn't try and bring it in, and I don't know why they wouldn't.
Well, some people listening to this might think, well, how could you not have this information at trial? You were stacking the deck on the side of the officer versus trying to really show what he's really like. But on the other side of the coin, I guess if we're all, in terms of legal statutes, allowed a fair trial, the attorneys for Van Dyke, Herbert and the rest, had argued that this case needed a change of venue, and the judge said no, because they argued that in this town where there was such uprising over this case once the video came out, there's no way he could get a fair trial. So I would imagine a judge with these kinds of witnesses,
you would think a jury hearing this would just go, that's it, you're guilty.
And that could happen, but Jason Van Dyke brought this on himself. He has 15 or 18 complaints against him. The regulatory agencies unfounded all of them, which is a whole separate topic that happens all the time in this city, and it's plainly wrong. But the judge could have decided that it was too prejudicial, and the state could have argued, look, this is a motive for him doing this. It goes to his motive. This is a young black man, and it's his anger towards young black men.
We do have actually some sound, Michael, of some of the people that have been testifying, so why don't we all let you in the control room sort of dictate this, and why don't you just give us the first piece of sound, and we'll just react to that.
He put the gun to my temple.
And what was his tone of voice when he was yelling at you?
It was as if he was just infuriated, just out of his mind, in my opinion.
So this is a man who is testifying that some years before the Laquan McDonald fatal shooting, that he was pulled over by Van Dyke and other officers and had a gun put to his temple and was also racially insulted, the N-word used. Again, if you would have seen this at trial, I'm sure the jury would have thought, well, this officer has a history of those jurors that voted to say, first-degree murder, but mitigating circumstances. They didn't feel it was racial. They said that after the jury came out, and they were allowed to be interviewed. They said they never looked at race. They just felt this officer, you know, went overboard, and maybe he had some reason for thinking, but he made the wrong decision. Had they heard this kind of stuff, I can just imagine they would have. It would have led anybody to believe the man has some racial issues.
This guy's testimony was compelling. It was believable. He has no motive to lie. He's getting no money from this. The opportunity to file a lawsuit is long since passed. He filed the complaint at the appropriate time, and IPRA or OPS ignored it, which is what they always do because they literally operate as an arm of the police department. He's compelling, and I agree with you. Any jury would hear this and go, wow, this guy's got a racial problem. He is racially profiling. He is a racist. And for whatever reason, the prosecutor decided not to make that an issue, or the judge shut them down on it because he said it was too prejudicial. He was never charged with a hate crime, which they might have done in federal court. So I don't know. I don't know if it was ever brought to the judge's attention.
Well, let me just stop you for one second. I mean, you're saying, you know, because in a sense, and I get where you're coming from, you're pretty much indicting what was the Office of Professional Standards, part arm of the police department to investigate things, because you've handled civil rights and cases and gone against police, and the feeling is that they just don't write things up properly. They're always there to defend the police department. And certainly things have changed over the years. And we had IPRA for a long time, and those kinds of complaints were made. And now we have COPA. And you could only hope that things are becoming more fair. But you don't look like you necessarily believe that. You feel that this is just icing on the cake?
I've been pretty outspoken on this issue in lots of cases, not just our own, where you have a guy here who has 15 or 18, I'm not sure what the number is, complaints against him. None of them are founded against him. You have a judgment against him for $350,000 in federal court where a jury felt that excessive force was used, and IPRA decides, nope, there's no issue because there's not enough witnesses. We have a problem here, and this goes to the systemic problem in this city where people file complaints, where there are incidents that happen, and nothing ever happens. I've got many, many police shootings where the man did not have a gun, and nothing happens to these guys. So there is a history. COPA is just a new version of the old version. It's a little more intelligent, but in my opinion, it's the same version of the old version.
I hope you're wrong, but anyway, next soundbite, one of the witnesses we heard testifying for the prosecution, which is obviously going for a tougher sentence for Van Dyke than the defense would want, but a young man, he stated that Officer Van Dyke had choked him.
You know what, I can't even look at the man right now. I just think of the night he choked me, and it just, he didn't have no remorse for nothing. I just can't look over that.
Now, this, as I recall, was a young man who stated he had admitted he had put a Hall's cough drop in his mouth after being handcuffed, knowing that he was going to have a breathalyzer test and thinking that this would somewhat undermine that test. So obviously an officer would become upset about that, but so what was the officer supposed to do? Not choke him, but...
This gentleman was perhaps not the greatest witness in the world.
Took a while to get there, yeah.
He has some issues. I think he has no reason to lie about the choking. You're not supposed to put a cough drop in your mouth to subvert the breathalyzer test. But they could have charged him with obstruction of justice. You can't go choke the guy to get the cough drop out of him. So that if that happened, that's horrible and a bunch of nonsense, and it shows that Van Dyke is using excessive force to manipulate tests, to manipulate his own cause out on the streets. So if it's true, which I have no reason to believe it wasn't, this guy took his plea on the DUI. This guy owned up to it. He owned up to it here. He owned up to putting the cough drop in his mouth. There's other ways to handle that. You don't choke the guy, and that's excessive force. And it goes along with now we're seeing a pattern, and what they're doing is they're methodically bringing a pattern of all the complaints against Van Dyke over the years. And as a side note, they're showing that they're all unfounded, but that's that whole separate subject.
One more now. Edward Nance, the one who's been crying continuously, which is a little hard to fathom so many years later, but on the one hand, post-traumatic stress disorder affects people in a myriad of ways. He also talks about things that happened in the military, but the diagnosis until later. He's also on an awful lot of medication that it just makes you sad for this man no matter what. But let's listen, and this would be the gentleman who his case was awarded a $350,000 jury verdict at trial. Let's listen.
You see him in the courtroom?
Yes.
And can you describe what he's wearing?
The shirt, yellow shirt.
Yellow shirt?
So, listening to this gentleman just cry, and we lost his testimony towards the end there because there is a camera difficulty with the pool camera that we're dealing with in the sentencing hearing. So once that's back up, we'll take you back in live. But some interesting points that I think bear making, Michael, is that going into this, the judge would not necessarily have known what these people were going to say unless they were witnesses that the prosecution wanted to use during the trial, but he nixed it. So it's conceivable that he doesn't know what all these people were going to say. If this is the first time that the judge has any inkling about this police brutality business and these racial name-calling, is there a chance that this is going to change his mind in terms of the sentence? Because you felt that going in, knowing Judge Gaughan, he would have already made up his mind about what the sentence needs to be.
I think, to be fair to Judge Gaughan, most judges would have read the briefs, they would have understood the law going into this. Judge Gaughan certainly didn't. He was well prepared, so he would have had a general idea. But Judge Gaughan clearly would have kept an open mind to anything he hears today, which can change his mind. And I know Judge Gaughan, he would do that. He went into this today with an open mind. He may or might have known what these witnesses are going to say, depending on what he asked the lawyers in chambers. They have to provide a witness list, and he may say, hey, what's this guy going to say? Because he doesn't want to have extraneous or duplicative information that doesn't help. He wants to run this case. But there is always a chance that this could change Judge Gaughan's mind in terms of the sentence or the number that he's going to do. These witnesses, in general, have been fairly effective in portraying a little bit about Jason Van Dyke.
Well, let me ask you this. If these witnesses, and they come off as very credible, if they, if this affects the sentence, making it stiffer, what about that I'm sure Dan Herbert would potentially like to argue about the three officers who were found not guilty yesterday in terms of covering up and were really related to the same case, but then it'd be the argument that that's a separate case, though. But yet it's all involved somehow.
He's clearly going to try and do that, but again, that's a different judge making a different determination on a whole different trial. These witnesses go towards Jason Van Dyke and his potential motive in leading up to what he did. Those other witnesses who potentially covered up and conspired to cover up with Jason Van Dyke have nothing to do with what he did before. It's to cover up what happened after. And that's why these witnesses are here important in sentencing.
Okay, so it goes back to what Jason Van Dyke did or didn't do. And again, what we don't know is how much Judge Gaughan would have known about the kind of things they were going to be saying.
Sure. He may have known some, because he may have said, what is this witness is going to say? What is this guy going to say? What is this guy going to say? And the lawyers would have told him, so he may or may not have known what's up. But it clearly could affect his perception of the case and what he's going to sentence Van Dyke to.
And as far as, if you're the judge on this now, in terms of weighing how prosecution and defense are doing in terms of the strategy, like tougher sentence, lesser sentence, where would you...
I think that I can question some of the strategy of the attorneys. Some of the cross-examinations have not been the greatest. But if I'm weighing this, I'm going to look at it. It's effective.
Well, we're back, so let's listen.
You made those against his partner last time, correct?
That's what that says. That's incorrect.
All right, nothing further. One second.
You gotta be kidding me.
Mr. Nance, relax a little bit.
Yes, sir.
Thanks, Mr. Nance.
Anything else? Anything else?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Sure. All right, Mr. McMahon. All right, fine. Yeah, listen. The attorneys can approach. Y'all have been acting like outstanding attorneys, so I know no harm's going to come any of the witnesses, so you can't approach without getting my permission, all right?
Thank you. Mr. Nance, you just read a paragraph from Defendant's Exhibit 2.
Yes.
That's a report prepared by somebody from the Chicago Police Department, correct? You didn't prepare that report, did you?
This guy right here interviewed by Investigator Darren Bowens. This is the guy that acted like he didn't care about what I was saying. This guy is not a police officer. This guy came from IPRA or OPS or whatever they are called now. This is the same guy that sent me the letter a year after I won my case telling me that they had nothing against Jason Van Dyke and they couldn't investigate him any further. If they would have investigated this guy...
Mr. Nance, slow down a little bit. All right, you've answered the question.
Yes, sir. Right, I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
When you were interviewed by that investigator at IPRA or COPA or whatever the agency was at the time when you reported it, you told him what Jason Van Dyke did to you on July 9th.
Yes.
And then when he prepared the report, he typed those words.
Yes.
And it's your testimony that what you told him is not accurately written down on that report.
True.
That's all. Thank you.
Mr. Sure. Go ahead.
But, Mr. Nance, you reviewed that statement and you signed it after you signed it after you read it.
Is that a question?
That's a question.
No, I did not review the statement because the guy acted like he didn't care what I was telling him in the first place.
But the guy gave it to you to review, correct?
He gave it to me to sign, I guess, and I did. That is my signature.
Okay. And that guy from OPS, Darren Bowens, can you describe him?
I think that guy was a black guy, big fat black guy that had too much to do, was too busy to even listen to what I was saying to him.
Okay.
Nothing else. All right. Mr. Nance, you can step down. Can I have the attorneys up here for scheduling, please? All right. How many more witnesses do you have? Let's just take a break right now. How about that? All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a 10-minute break. For everybody in the courtroom, I guess there was a technical difficulty. Some of the TV feed was not broadcast, but you're here live and in person. All right, there'll be a short recess.
Well, I guess the judge just made it clear it wasn't our fault here at CLT and WGN that there was a technical difficulty. It was in the courtroom with the camera feed. Right. So they're taking another short recess. This has been compelling stuff. It's the defense's job now in terms of these witnesses to try to slightly undermine what they're saying, that it wasn't necessarily about Jason Van Dyke, but I don't know that they're really able to do that.
I don't think they are. I mean, you can say some of them are adding stuff. They really have no motives to lie. They're not getting paid. There's no civil suits anymore. You can say they hate this guy or they hate the police. It may be true, but I don't think there's any way to really undermine them. They're coming across as credible. It's just a question of, like you said, what is the effect of that on the judge?
On the judge, because he's the deciding factor here in terms of the
but
sentence.
But it does give you another version of Van Dyke that we've never heard before. It does open a window into him, and I would assume when the defense takes over, they're going to try and show his family and show what a wonderful person he is to combat this impression that he's a racist beast on the job.
But ultimately going to appeal, which is where the defense is going to take this no matter what, this kind of stuff on record, I think would make it that much more difficult for the appellate court judges to say, because they're going to take sentencing testimony into account, won't they?
They will. And what they're really going to look at is how excessive it was, given the facts, given what happened, how reasonable it was. You know, so I haven't seen anything yet that's going to affect the sentence, the appeal on sentencing. We haven't heard what the sentence is.
Right.
So.
All right. Well, we are going to take a break. We'll be back with more of this as it continues. Court is in recess right now, but this is Inside the Courtroom with CLTV at the Jason Van Dyke sentencing hearing. Michael, we're back a little sooner than I expected, but court is back in session, so let's listen in, and then we'll talk about things once they recess again.
Okay. And that's not an offensive term, just so we're national TV and everything else like that, okay?
That's correct.
Thank you. All right. Ann, raise your right hand. Do you swear to interpret from sign language, from English to sign language and sign language to English to the best of your ability?
I do.
All right. Let's get June. June, raise your right hand. Do you swear or affirm to interpret from sign language to visual gestural communication and from visual gestural communication to sign language?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. Now, what would be a comfortable position for both of you? We're going to have the witness here. Let me know what would be good for y'all.
Your Honor, I will be standing, the American Sign Language Interpreter will be standing behind the witness stand, and Ms. Kusak is speaking, saying I will stand in front of the witness stand.
So you're going to be behind?
Correct.
Okay, good. Come on back here, Ann. And then June? You're not paying attention, June. All right. Okay, June is good there. All right, bring the witness out, please. Thank you. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You swear. That's easy. You know, do you want to do this?
No.
Okay. Don't be arguing you on national TV. Okay. Parks?
I'll project here.
And here these are. I made this people. Could you stand here? Yeah, I know that.
Would
you please do it here, and then we'll work it out like that. If it doesn't work, you know, if June says it doesn't work, then we'll adjust.
Okay, bring him over.
Yes.
All
right. Sir, remain standing.
Raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God? Yes, thank you.
Have a seat, please. Could you pull your chair up to the microphone? I'm sorry. We don't need to do that right now. All right. Proceed, Mr. Wasser.
Sir, could you please state your name and spell your last name?
Alberto Luces, L-U-C-E-S.
I'm going to draw your attention to March of 2013. Did you have occasion to file a complaint against Officer Jason Van Dyke in that month? Remember that incident?
Yes, I remember. Yeah.
Where were you coming from before you were pulled over by police on that day?
Just for a short time. It was really close. I got in the car. I was driving for a moment, and I got pulled over right away. I didn't even really drive that far. I just kind of pulled up a little bit, and that's when I was pulled over.
Did you commit any traffic violations while you were driving for that short period? When you were pulled over, did officers approach the car?
Yes, the police came up.
And what did they do?
Get out of the car. I tried explaining to them that I was deaf. I tried motioning, and then they twisted my arm really hard, and it hurt a lot. I wasn't sure what I had done. There was another officer that was poking me in my left shoulder. Somebody was trying to make a video, but then the officer told them, no, no, and I was trying to deal with the pain. Now, I was hurt, and I was upset, and I was trying to just communicate with them that I'm deaf.
And was there one officer that was an African American? And was there one white officer?
Yes.
If you were to see the white officer again, do you think you'd recognize him?
So, yeah.
Do you see him in court today?
Should I?
Do you see the white officer?
Maybe you could advise that he might want to stand up and take a look around.
Sir, could you stand up and take a look around the courtroom and see if you see the white officer in court today?
I don't see see that well at a distance. I was injured in the past, and my vision to see far is not that good right now, and I did not bring my glasses with me.
Excuse me. Could I, Mr. Weiler, Mr. Herbert, over here for a second? Because Mr. Lucas does not have his glasses, I am going to direct him to stand up, go by Mr. Weiler, and then look around the complete courtroom to see if that officer is present in this courtroom today. I want you to direct him that he has to look around the complete car. You can step down at this time. Putting your hand up, you're going to go to jail. You understand me? Where do you think you're at? You, with the thumb. Tell him to leave the courtroom and get his name and don't let him leave till I discuss something with him, all right? Sir, do you know how to sign before you leave?
No, sir.
All right, then hold him outside. All right, did he see anybody? Can he identify anybody? Yeah, can we come back up here, please? Thank you. Have a seat, sir. Thank you. All right, ask your questions.
Really hard time seeing.
And to tell Mr. Lucas that we really appreciate that.
I tried to look and I tried to see, but it's been a long time, you know. But that was back in 2013, and from that time until today, I was beaten up very badly. I was hit in the head, and there was a lot of blood. So.
But you are sure that you filed a complaint against Officer Jason Van Dyke?
All right, Mr. Weiler, establish how many police officers are out there that day? Because if he can't identify which police officer did this, then...
Judge, I think there is an easily identifiable way.
Well, to get to it, then, okay.
All right.
Before I strike the testimony.
All right.
Yes, I do remember that I filed a complaint against Jason Van Dyke, and this is the interpreter speaking. Just one moment for us to catch up.
Officers were there that day.
Two.
And one was white and one was black?
Yes.
And the black one twisted your arm behind your back, correct?
Twisted it very hard.
What did the white officer do?
There is no connection that Officer Van Dyke was out there that day.
Judge, I
filing a complaint doesn't mean that he was present. That's just an allegation. You need somebody to put him there geographically, or the testimony isn't, there's no nexus for the testimony.
Indicated that you had filed a complaint against Officer Jason Van Dyke. Was he one of the two officers that pulled you over that day?
Sustained. Mr. White, you have established that he has, Mr. Lewis has been pulled over that day, but you haven't, by saying a name, that doesn't put that name with the defendant in this case. John, get back. Get back. I can see you moving. Now, why don't you capture the interpreters? That's unusual in a court case. Shut it down.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. There's no further questions.
Thank you. Sir, I want to thank you very much for coming in here today. And I really respect your integrity and your honesty. So thank you. You can step down now. Thanks.
So I'm done? I'm really done?
Yes. June, and let June know. All right, thank you very much. You guys are great. Okay. All right, State, could you call your next witness, please?
The State would call Reverend Marvin Hunter. Read a victim impact statement.
Coming up.
Yes.
just have the reverend sit down for a second while we have the sidebar. Do you want it on the record or?
Probably on the record.
We'll make a decision.
On the record. Yeah.
Sidebar right now. They said on the record, so we thought we might hear it. But interestingly, Michael Oppenheimer, this last witness who's deaf, could not identify Jason Van Dyke in the courtroom. It just seems sort of odd that the prosecution wouldn't have had this set up better. It's their witness.
I'm sure the public is saying, what is this? Is this a joke? This is very unusual. There's two possibilities. One is that the witness was afraid or for whatever reason purposely did not identify Jason Van Dyke in the courtroom. You're absolutely correct that the prosecution should have had this set up, should have anticipated things, should have made sure there is an ID. This is a big case. That was an important witness, and now that witness is lost forever. So either they didn't set it up properly, which is on the prosecution, they didn't prepare him, or this guy flipped at the last minute and said, I'm not going to identify him.
Now, we've seen in cases where there are gangbangers involved, gang accusations, and when, as we saw in the case for the murder of Chicago Honor student Heidi Pendleton, gangbangers were brought up on the witness stand and they suddenly had no recollection of anything. So it was clear that they weren't going to testify. In this case, who would this guy be afraid of? You'd think other police officers, it's hard to fathom.
It's hard to speculate. Maybe the police department. They could have maybe corrected it, showing him a picture of Van Dyke saying, didn't you have a conversation with me last week? And didn't you identify this picture as the person that did this to you? And now you're saying it's not him? So that's what you do when these gangbangers recant. As a defense attorney, happens all the time. It's great for the defense attorney. The prosecutor should say, hey, we had a conversation last week, you said it was him, and now you impeach the credibility of the witness.
The chair is adjustable, the microphone's live. Pull your seat up to the microphone, adjust the microphone, and everybody will be able to hear your testimony. It would be greatly appreciated. So thank you. Proceed, Mr. McMahon.
Reverend, would you take your name, spell your last name for the court, please?
Marvin Hunter, H-U-N-T-E-R.
And you're a... Can you tell us what you do for a living?
Pastor of the Grace Memorial Missionary Baptist Church.
You're related to Laquan McDonald, correct?
I am.
What is Laquan's relation to you?
I am Laquan's great-uncle.
Reverend Hunter, you prepared a victim impact statement for the family of Laquan McDonald, correct?
Yes, sir.
I'm going to show you what I've marked as People's Sentencing Exhibit Number 1 for identification. Ask you to review that. That's the victim impact statement that you prepared for this case, correct?
Yep. Yes, sir.
Are you prepared to read the victim impact statement?
I am.
Please do so.
Mr. McMahon, I thought you were going to put in a little clarification here.
Reverend, when you prepared the victim impact statement, you prepared the statement as if it was being written by Laquan McDonald, correct?
Correct.
You wrote it in his voice.
Correct.
These are your words, correct?
Correct.
And the words of your family?
Correct.
Well, you're going to present those words as you prepared them in the first person as if they were written by Laquan McDonald.
Correct.
May he read the statement, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you.
Go ahead, Your
Honor. I'm a 17-year-old boy. I'm a victim of murder in the second degree and 16 counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. And I am unable to speak with my own voice for the crimes of which I was accused and suspected. of the cause of a Chicago police officer by the name of Jason Van Dyke, who decided that he would become judge, jury, and executioner on Monday, October the 20th, 2014. I had a job at the time of my death, a job where I was working construction. I would have received what has become my last check on the 24th of October, but 4 days after, I was murdered. My great uncle, Pastor Marvin Hunter, had to pay for my funeral and then be reimbursed by the state, and also took my last check to purchase the suit that I had on in my casket, as well as my mother and my sister's clothes for my funeral. The saddest part of this ordeal is for my mom and my sister. My mother, who had worked very hard to overcome drug addiction and learn the skills of being a responsible parent, was only weeks away from her, myself, and my sister to be reunited as one family in our own house, with my mom being the head of the house and my sister and I being the children. I was so happy for the possibility of that day. However, Jason Van Dyke, with his cold, callous, and disregard for the life of a young black man, without me provoking him, robbed us of this. The story of my life is that in the short time of my life, I have worked hard to correct the mistakes that I had made, but in a matter of 6 seconds, he then took 16 shots and ended the possibility of this happening forever. From the time of my birth, my mother, sister, and myself live with my great-grandmother. And under this kind of situation, the great-grandmother was the mother to all, but in a house with my mother, my baby sister, and I. I would have had my own room, my sister, her own room, and we would have had all the attention of our mother. These are the words of my great uncle, Pastor Marvin Hunter. My death has brought inconsolable pain to my mother and my baby sister, enormous pain to my family as a whole. But we are a people of faith and believe that time is our best medicine for healing a pain of this kind. Even though I am dead, my murder at the hand of Jason Van Dyke should not be minimized just to his conviction. I want the judge to know about me, what I have suffered, and what my life was like. What happened to me can never be changed, but other young black men and women would not have to face Mr. Jason Van Dyke and his evil and selfish ways. For he has not just destroyed my life and affected my family, but he has destroyed the life of his wife and children, as well as my family and his family. I'm a real victim of murder, and that can never be changed. Please think about me and about my life when you sentence this person to prison. Why should this person, who has ended my life forever because he chose to become judge, jury, and executioner and has never asked for forgiveness, be free when I'm dead forever?
Thank you, Ron. Your Honor, we would offer people sentencing exhibit number one for identification of the evidence for your consideration.
That is moved into evidence. The identification marks are stricken.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. Earl?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And then, Your Honor, the Reverend can now stay in the courtroom.
Absolutely.
Just We would offer people sentencing exhibit number 2 for identification. This would be a victim impact statement of Eddie Meeks the 3rd. I'm not going to read it or ask that it be published, and I'd ask to offer that at this time.
Any objections?
No objection.
All right, certainly that will become part of the record, and it will be moved into evidence. At this time, Mr. McMahon.
Judge, at this time, the people would rest their case in aggravation against the defendant's case.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have been going since 9 a.m. this morning. I don't mind if we go straight through, but there's other people to consider. So I want everybody back here at 2:30. All right, the doors will be closed at 2:30 if you're not here. All right, there'll be a recess till then.
So they're taking a break, presumably a lunch break, so just a little over 45 minutes, and court will be back in session, and we'll be here for you to continue with this inside the courtroom for the sentencing hearing for former Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke in the 2014 shooting death of black teen Laquan McDonald. That was a very eloquent statement by the Reverend in terms of his nephew. We sometimes forget that no matter what a kid's involved in, they had expectations and things to look forward to, and they had a family that misses them terribly.
Absolutely. This was a young kid who apparently was trying to get his life together. He had problems. We know that he was on PCP, but he was a kid. The family had a lot of issues. It's no excuse for what Jason Van Dyke did. And I think the Reverend read a great letter from an interesting perspective that was effective. And the judge will listen to that and take that into consideration.
Since you've seen more of this kind of thing than we would have, that was interesting to me that he read it in the voice of Laquan McDonald. Is that a common thing to do for a victim? Have you seen that before?
I've heard a lot of victim impact statements, both as a prosecutor and a defense attorney. I've never seen that angle, if you will, that perspective, but I thought it was effective. Very effective.
He admitted that his life had been, he didn't go into that he was using drugs and all the rest, but he did go, you know, his life had been hard, and he'd been looking forward to this time now where he and his mother and sister could be reunited again. So just, it does sort of add, tie it all together, I guess, for the prosecution in terms of showing that they've been trying to show that this police officer had a record of altercations with people that weren't taken care of. He was never disciplined. There was even a $350,000 civil jury verdict in one case, and now you have ultimately, though, a police officer. I guess what they're saying is a police officer that was never dealt with, never punished in periodic instances, and now a young man is gone and there's no bringing him back.
Exactly. We didn't get to hear from that other witness for whose ever mistake, but they painted a perspective of a troubled officer who has a lot of issues, who the argument is probably either should have been dealt with in terms of discipline, retraining, or get him off the force. But because he wasn't taken off the street, here we are today.
And then, again, this isn't a jury listening to this now. This isn't any of that. This is the judge, Judge Gaughan, who will weigh this as part of everything that he takes into consideration. And we haven't yet heard. The next part of this will be hearing the defense side and the witness statements that they give to try to show Jason Van Dyke in another light. What would you expect there moving into that part?
I would expect we're going to hear from family members about, I don't know if the children are testify. His wife is certainly going to probably testify about what a great person he was, how we miss him, we want him back in our family. It was a bad day, and we will probably hear from Jason Van Dyke. Jason Van Dyke during the trial was not apologetic. He was adamant and defiant. It didn't go well for him for that. I would assume, although I don't know the way this thing is going, that he's going to change his attitude, and I would assume that he'll be asked for forgiveness.
Interesting. We'll see if you're right about
we'll see
that.
If I'm right. I could be wrong.
Yeah, well, it's a strategy, and certainly after everything that's happened, you could see where that is, where he would be at this point.
You would hope.
Well, we're going to take a break, and we'll go with regular programming until 2:30, just a little bit before that. So 45 minutes from now, once the court is back in session, we'll be back to bring you there live. This is a CLTV News special report inside the courtroom. Back in a bit.